This is Tuesday, April 12th, 2005, 10:30 a.m. This is time and place for the Public Utilities Commission in the State Capitol Building in room 412 in Pierce, South Dakota. We're going to check to see who is on the line with us. Pat Mastel.
Present, Mr. Commissioner.
Colleen Svold.
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Melissa Thompson.
Yes, I'm here,
Mr. Chairman. Carol, would you pronounce your last name for me, please? Perkinper. Jeff Decker.
Here, Mr. Chairman.
Malaya Tassi. Brad Chardon.
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Beth Kohler.
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Ann Hansen. Pam Harrington.
Here.
Thank you. I'm joined today, this is Gary Hansen, I'm joined today by Commissioners Bob Saar and Commissioner Dusty Johnson. The first item on the agenda is the administrative item, approval of the minutes of the Commission meeting held on March 8, 2005. Is there a motion for approval of the minutes?
I move for approval.
Second.
I concur. Motion carries. Consumer issues, item number one under consumer issues, Jim Milhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commission has received a total of 498 consumer contacts during 2005. 201 of these contacts have been received since the last report was prepared for the March 8, 2005 Commission meeting. 68 of the contacts for this period involve telecommunication services. 29 of the contacts involve electrical services. 8 contacts involve natural gas services. 16 contacts involve gas and electric services. 35 contacts involved cellular phone services, 12 contacts were related to the Do Not Call Registry, and 33 contacts involved miscellaneous items not regulated by the PUC. 392 of the 498 complaints received in 2005 have been resolved, and 2,071 of the 2,370 contacts received in 2004 have been resolved at this time.
Thank you very much, Jim. Are there any questions of Jim? First item under electricity is EL04-015 in the matter of the petition of Northern States Power Company doing business as Xcel Energy for approval to include certain renewable energy development fund costs in the electric fuel adjustment clause. And the question before the commission today is, how shall the commission proceed? Mr. Wilcox.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, my name is Jim Wilcox. I work for Xcel Energy in South Dakota. I think on the phone today is Ann Hansen and Michelle Swanson from Minneapolis. Maybe could I just ask if can they hear us?
Yes, we are here.
Okay.
Is Ann Hansen on the line now?
Yeah, I am.
Thank you.
I have Ann here to help answer accounting and allocation questions, and Michelle serves on the Renewable Development Fund Board, and I think she can answer questions about how the program works. Xcel comes today seeking approval of cost recovery for part of a renewable energy development fund that we have committed to in order to keep our low-cost nuclear power plants running in Minnesota. I've got some background information I feel compelled to provide, but you know, please feel to interrupt me with questions if I seem to be talking too much. So, as you know, we've been working to manage the spent nuclear fuel at Prairie Island for some time now. In 1994, the Minnesota legislature agreed to authorize the company to install up to 17 dry storage casks on a gravel pad outside of the Prairie Island plant. In exchange for that authorization, the company agreed to, and the Minnesota legislature mandated 400 megawatts of wind development. In addition, that 1994 legislation also required us to establish a renewable development fund. And the statute called for $500,000 per cask per year to be placed in that fund. Now, as Yucca Mountain is not going to be open before 2007, we went back to the Minnesota legislature again in 2003 seeking more dry casks, and they approved up to 12 more casks in exchange for another 300 megawatts of wind power on top of another 400 megawatts that the Minnesota PUC had mandated in 1998. So our total commitment to wind power right now is 1,125 megawatts. In exchange for these additional dry casks, the Renewable Development Fund was modified to become a fixed $16 million per year. Now, the law requires about $6 million to be spent for other renewable purposes. So we expect to be disbursing about $10 million for each year of the program. And of that $10 million, about half is expected to be awarded to projects that actually produce electricity directly as opposed to research and development projects. And it is this portion, these projects that actually produce electricity, that portion of the Renewable Development Fund program that we are here today seeking cost recovery for. The allocation to South Dakota is expected to be about $200,000 a year. Now, we've worked out a deal with staff, and I'm going to let Steve Wegman talk about that. But what we are essentially asking for today is a limited approval. That is cost recovery of the Renewable Development Fund money awarded to energy production projects. The time period we're asking cost recovery for are the years 2004, 2005, 2006. And that's a total of about $500,000 for those 3 years. As we're planning a rate case for next year, the deal we're proposing would then be renewed and ostensibly restructured at that time. In exchange for this approval, Xcel Energy will agree to purchase the output of 50 megawatts of wind power to be located within the state of South Dakota. Now, I guess I'll let Steve talk about the settlement agreement, and I'll stand by for questions. But in conclusion, Xcel Energy respectfully requests commission approval of the energy production project portion of the Renewable Development Fund.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is Steve Wegman, staff analyst for the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission. I just want to make sure you have you seen a copy of the stipulation agreement between staff and Xcel?
I have
Nuclear generation is an important function to Xcel and for the low-cost energy supply to South Dakota Xcel customers. One of the things to point out is Xcel's been kind of reluctant to install wind energy outside the state of Minnesota. And to help further that, this is one of the things that was driving staff in coming to the stipulation. I should point out that staff is not in unanimous acceptance of the stipulation. And this is something that I've kind of taken the lead on, pushing Xcel in promoting wind energy outside of the Minnesota boundaries. Xcel had made a filing back in 2003 and had withdrawn it after some of the staff discussion on quite a bit of research money was being allocated, not eligible for South Dakota customers, yet South Dakota customers would have been paying the expense. In coming back with a filing back in May of 2000, Xcel had removed the research items and came back with a proposed 50 megawatts of wind energy in South Dakota. One of the things I should point out is that under the fuel adjustment clause, this may not be the most appropriate way to do it and maybe something the commission should take a look at and have staff and Xcel come back and file, make an additional filing, and put this under regulatory assets with a tracking cost with adjustments made at the next rate case. At this time, commission staff's looking for advice from the commissioners. How should we proceed?
Thank you. Jim, did you have anything further to add?
I do not, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone on staff that wishes to make a presentation at this moment other than Steve. Thank you. Jim, you had stated that Minnesota requires now 1,125 megawatts of renewable.
Of wind power.
And
there are some other kinds of renewable requirements, biomass. I didn't speak to those, but they're also part of the 94 and 2003 legislation.
And thank you. And where do they require that all of that be done in Minnesota? Is there a requirement to the location of that?
No, the original statute 94 did call for the first 200 megawatts to be within the state of Minnesota, but since then, I'm not sure whatever reason, but the statute is not specifically stated it needs to be in Minnesota. I think there's a statement to the effect that it has to be a least cost resource, and the Minnesota PUC is kind of the determines which of those renewables or which of those wind projects are would be least cost. So the answer is no. To my knowledge, there are no restrictions that would limit current wind development projects to be within the state of Minnesota.
Except that least cost, does that mean to imply that the Minnesota PUC makes a determination then as to whether if it's located in South Dakota or Minnesota, it's least cost?
Well, that's my understanding, yes.
So, in essence, they can place all of it in Minnesota?
I think that's possible.
Has any wind at this juncture been placed outside of Minnesota?
No.
How many megawatts have been placed in Minnesota?
I want to say that right now we are in the approaching 500 megawatts.
And all of it in Minnesota?
Yes.
And with this discussion or... with this proposal, you're stating that Xcel would provide 50 megawatts in South Dakota.
That's right.
How can you guarantee that if the Minnesota has the ability to dictate where it's located?
Well, the settlement agreement calls for that if we are not able to do that, that we would then refund these renewable development fund monies that we've asked recovery for here. I'm reasonably confident that we're going to be able to make this 50 megawatts happen in South Dakota. We've just, I didn't mention this, but we did get commitment in North Dakota for 12 megawatts in North Dakota. And it's 12 because that's the transmission capability of that area. So that was kind of the limiting factor, I think. But I'm reasonably confident we'll be able to make 50 megawatts happen in South Dakota. But if we don't, the settlement agreement would call for a refund of this of these renewable development fund monies that we're asking for here.
You're familiar with the ridge in the northeast corner of the South
very,
Dakota?
Very much so.
Extending up from Buffalo Ridge in Minnesota?
Yes.
And that is primarily where most of the Minnesota wind power is. Do you have knowledge of how many megawatts of wind under today's technology could be carried along that?
In South Dakota?
Yes.
I do not, Mr. Chairman. I mean, it's significant.
It's significantly larger than the Buffalo Ridge area.
I think that's fair to say.
And Buffalo Ridge is the largest in the nation at the present time, correct?
I'm not sure about that either. I mean, there are other states that might claim to be the largest, but there's over 400 megawatts on the Buffalo Ridge in Minnesota now. So, I mean, there's a significant amount of wind power on the Buffalo Ridge in Minnesota.
It just seems, and I think you can get the message of what I'm referring to, where I'm going with this, is that 50 megawatts just does not seem like a very large amount of energy, especially with South Dakota taxpayers paying into it. And if we truly are interested in renewables, and I don't wish to put you necessarily on the spot because I understand Xcel's challenge with Minnesota legislature and perhaps as much as anything else, I'm speaking to Michelle Swanson of the Renewable Fund, but it seems to be, it's challenging for me to look at this and say that 50 megawatts is a reason for us to, it's a carrot, but it's a very tiny carrot for us to look at this. We really have to look at a number of other issues here, and frankly, I would like to see it at least 10 times that amount. I have another area, and then I have some additional questions beyond this, but I'll just ask a couple more and then let the other commissioners.
Let me respond, Gary, your commissioner, to that. You know, this is a first step. I mean, this opens the door for additional wind development in South Dakota. I mean, I agree there is a lot of potential there, and I think it's reasonable to expect some significant wind development in South Dakota. We've got to open the door at some point, and I think this is a way to open the door.
And yet you're saying that if it's not in the fuel clause, that you'd refund the money and not direct the activities towards building. I think Xcel can pursue some of these things beyond this, and
I expect that it's up to the developers really where they locate the wind machines, and it's wherever the wind resource is the best. We're planning on transmission line development into South Dakota, particularly from that White South Dakota area over to Lake Benton, I think will be a collector substation for a wind farm in South Dakota. So, I mean, I think that itself speaks to the fact that we are envisioning some wind development in South Dakota. I mean, I think it's my personal view is that the Buffalo Ridge of Minnesota is pretty much saturated with wind development, and the South Dakota side is just pure undeveloped, and so there's
exactly.
A tremendous opportunity, and I think that's where the cost-effective wind development sites are going to be in the next decade. So I see this as a first step in towards seeing that development.
All right. I'll reiterate that a first step or not, I'd prefer to see 500 megawatts as opposed to 50. There's somewhat of a precedent being set here if we were to approve this as part of a fuel clause. Can you or someone else give us some comfort as to why this should be part of a fuel clause?
Well,
it's more of a regulation and a cost of regulation.
I mean, I can see that there's a case to be made that this is something that probably should be better handled in a rate case. We're a year away from having a rate case, and we've got some expenses that are going to be incurred between now and that time, and so I guess it'd be my opinion that this would be the best way for us to seek cost recovery from the commission this year without having a rate case to do it. I think, Nick, as we've said in the agreement, that next year we expect to have a rate case, and this agreement only covers up through 2006, and so we're expecting to have this conversation again, during the time of rate case next year.
Do you have any comment? I wasn't able to digest all of Mr. Wegman's comments as I was looking at the information that he'd handed out, but he made some statements pertaining to what might be a better idea is to defer this and pursue it in another avenue.
I've not talked to Steve about that.
Do you have any thoughts pertaining to that?
I mean, well, we're open to whatever the commission wants us to do. We proposed handling it through the fuel clause, and we're asking for that today. If we need to do something else, we will.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Other commissioners?
Good morning, Mr. Wilcox. The fuel adjustment clause does seem to be an odd provision to bring this through, and I think we have to be concerned about following the law, obviously, and also any sort of possible precedents we might be setting here. And that I think you can tell from the commissioner's questions, that seems to be a big bone of contention. And there may be some other ways we might be able to look at structuring this that accomplish a lot of the goals that maybe you're trying to meet while still making sure that we follow the law and do the right things for the consumer and ratepayers. So I personally would encourage Xcel to have an open mind about how to approach this. But we certainly would have difficulty going against what the law says as a stated purpose of the fuel adjustment clause. And, I mean, can you acknowledge that it is a little bit of a shoehorn trying to bring it into that clause with its current language?
Certainly.
The other question that certainly gets begged in a situation like this, and it has come up from time to time, and right now there's some legislation that's being debated in Minnesota that I know give people in the utility business a lot of concern about potential impact on rates and ratepayers. And obviously, we need to keep these nuclear power plants open. They're an important source of low-cost power. And we realize that there is certainly going to be occasionally be permitting fees, licensing, so on and so forth. And with the problems associated with Yucca Mountain, there are going to have to be some kind of ongoing negotiations with the state of Minnesota. You know, at the same time, I think I would be missing an opportunity to state some of the frustrations that I've certainly heard among utilities, among commissions outside of Minnesota, concerns about Minnesota putting mandates on the state of South Dakota, on North Dakota, on some other states within their system that frankly are quite possibly adding some significant costs to the rates. And certainly we would encourage Xcel, or I would encourage Xcel to do everything it can to make sure that any sort of settlements, any sort of negotiations are kept at a minimum as far as the potential costs and impact on ratepayers. And frankly, also look to see if we can't come up with settlements that encourage the best solutions. Because that kind of gets me to the third point. In the concept of least cost, I don't know if the magic number is 50, 500, 5,000 megawatts in South Dakota, but we definitely want to see, you know, smart choices made with locating any type of energy production facility, whether it be a wind farm or whatever else it might be. And I definitely have some concerns. One, I would like to see it in South Dakota, but two, also, I want to see it located where the wind resource is the best. And, you know, all the research that I can point to indicates that South Dakota, we have many, many sites that are significantly better than Minnesota. So just in terms of analyzing this from what is best for the ratepayers, if you're looking at doing 1,125 megawatts of wind for whatever reason, I would definitely strongly encourage Xcel to look to see where they can do that best and where they can do it generating the most electricity at the lowest possible rates. And at least my research, initial research, would indicate that's going to be in South Dakota as opposed to Minnesota. And I think that just makes sense from a ratepayer and a consumer standpoint to encourage Xcel to look at South Dakota wind and analyze in the context of is it going to be a better resource than Minnesota. I think the answer is going to be that it will be, especially going forward. So, you know, those are the concerns that I have looking at the question of whether or not to run this through the RDF. And I've probably gone a step further than that, but certainly want you to understand some of the issues that I kind of see as overarching this whole entire thing. Now, again, I think there may be some ways that we can look at accomplishing a lot of the same goals here and to do so in a way that we can look at and feel that, you know, clearly passes legal muster. So, again, I would encourage Xcel to keep an open mind about it. And certainly, I look nothing but favorably upon the offer to tee up wind in South Dakota. And 50 megawatts out of 1125, relatively small, might lead to more, probably would lead to more. And certainly, it's not insignificant, as that would be our state's largest wind farm if it were, in fact, built before something else is done in terms of other wind farms. So I certainly don't want to in any way, shape, or form discount or indicate anything other than certainly a very positive feeling towards the offer to look at getting wind power going in the state of South Dakota.
Morning, Mr. Wilcox. Mr. Wegman talked about a reluctance on the part of Xcel to install wind in South Dakota. Do you think that is an accurate representation? And if so, could you talk a little bit about some of the reasons for that reluctance?
Oh, I don't know if it's a reluctance on the part of our company. Certainly the state of Minnesota caused some of that with the initial statute that required the first 200 megawatts to be located in Minnesota. And
And I guess that many policymakers in Minnesota would like to see much of that development happen in Minnesota. But I don't think the company, I mean, the company's business is trying to provide electricity to our customers at the lowest cost possible. And, you know, if we can get that done by having wind machines in South Dakota, I don't think we'd see any difference in that state border, that, you know, Brookings County to Minnesota. So, you know, we're affected by legislative actions that are taken in Minnesota, and I know there's a Senator Ellen Anderson in Minnesota right now has got a bill that would, you know, seek to constrain future wind development to be located in Minnesota, and we're opposing that. Our company's opposing that. So just because of the fact it probably would preclude some lower cost options. So, I mean, I don't know this. So, bottom line, I don't think it's a reluctance on the part of our company, but it certainly we're affected by our neighbors in Minnesota.
How are your cost recovery efforts for these regulatory costs going in other states that Xcel serves?
I might have to. I know about North Dakota, and the North Dakota Commission has denied this request in North Dakota. Maybe. Michelle, can you help me with Minnesota? How are we recovering these costs in Minnesota?
This is Ann Hansen. I'll answer that.
Thank you.
In Minnesota, we recover 100% of the research and development type projects, and we recover the Minnesota allocated portion of the energy production projects. Also funded through the Renewable Development Fund are renewable energy production incentives, which are also recovered 100% through from Minnesota, state of Minnesota customers. The administrative costs associated with this project are recovered from Minnesota customers based on the same formula that we included in our petition in South Dakota, which is the Minnesota portion of those administrative costs associated with energy production projects, and then 100% of the costs associated with renewable research and development projects. In Wisconsin, I can tell you that the cost for the Renewable Development Fund allocated for the energy production projects assigned through the interchange agreement to Wisconsin are being included in their current or their pending, I guess, or rate case. It will include the 2006 test year.
Ms. Hansen, Commissioner Johnson here. What is the mechanism for recovery of those costs? Is that through the fuel clause in Minnesota?
No. In Minnesota, we have a separate rider for the Renewable Development Fund.
Okay. Thank you. I share Chairman Hansen's and Commissioner Saar's concerns about the fuel clause not being an appropriate mechanism for cost recovery. And with that, I would make a motion to deny the petition and instead direct Xcel to accumulate those costs in a separate account by vintage from 2004 forward, including any carrying charges based on the rate of return that the Commission has approved in the past or at last allowed by the Commission. For our future consideration in the form of a potentially recoverable regulatory asset, and certainly our consideration of recovery of these costs would take place within the framework of Xcel's next filing for a rate change.
Second.
And I concur.
Thank you, Mr. Wilcox.
Thank you.
Item number two is EL05-005 in the matter of the joint request for an electric service rights exception between Central Electric Cooperative Incorporated and the City of Plankinton. And the question today before the Commission is, shall the Commission grant the service rights exception? Michelle.
Thank you. Excuse me. Central Electric Cooperative and the City of Plankinton filed a joint service rights exception agreement. Central Electric is seeking approval to provide service to an outdoor sign that's located within Lot D of F&S Noble's First Edition. It's a subdivision of the unplatted portion of the north half of the southeast quarter of Section 22 and the unplatted portion of the southeast quarter of the southeast quarter of Section 22, all lying east of Main Street of the City of Plankinton. The owners of the sign are in agreement with the request. Both parties believe this exchange will avoid unnecessary duplication of facilities, and Central Electric would provide adequate electric service to the sign, and the arrangement would promote the efficient and economical use and development of their respective electric systems. Staff would agree that this service rights exception is in the public interest and would recommend the Commission approve the request for the electric service rights exception.
Thank you, Michelle. Any questions? If not, Commission action.
I move that we grant the service rights exception.
Second.
I concur. Motion carries. Before going any further, at the top of the agenda, I should have announced that it's our intent to move items 1 and 2 under telecommunications. Telecommunications item 1 and 2 will be moved to the end of the agenda. And the item under electricity, that is an addendum, will be moved up to the last item on the electricity. It will come just before natural gas. We are on item number 3 under electric, EL05-006, in the matter of the filing by Northwestern Corporation, doing business as Northwestern Energy, for approval of tariff revisions. And the question before the Commission is, shall the Commission approve the tariff revisions? Dave.
Yes. Thank you, Chairman. The company has requested deferral of this item until the next Commission meeting. The legal representation for the company was not able to be present today and wished to be so.
Thank you. Is there a motion?
I would move to defer.
Second.
Concur. Next item is the addendum item, electric EL05-004, in the matter of the joint request for an electric service rights exception between Southeastern Electric Cooperative Incorporated and MidAmerican Energy Company. The question before the Commission is, shall the Commission grant the service rights exception? Michelle.
Thank you, Chairman Hansen. Brad Chardine's on the phone. I don't know if he would like to speak to this.
Thanks, Michelle and Chairman Hansen. I guess it's just one of those situations where we don't have line in every area, and based on some of our assignments of territories back in 1976, Mid-America happens to have a line with an irrigation system in close proximity to where one of our members has requested service, and for us to build about 3 miles of distribution line to serve that, there was a pretty substantial aid to construction for the member, and the member requested that we ask Mid-America for the potential or the ability to serve that load. And in doing so, we requested a letter from the member that we could, or they were in favor of transferring service rights to Mid-America, and we're coming to you with a request to be able to do that so the member can have access to Mid-America's line and be able to irrigate in that 60 acres of land that he has there.
Thank you, Brad. Any questions? Michelle, did you have anything further?
No, staff would just agree with Mr. Chardine that this is in the public interest and would benefit the member of the co-op.
Okay. I'll make a motion for approval on EL05-004.
Second.
I concur.
Motion carries. Next item is natural gas. We have item 1, NG05-002, the matter of the application of Montana Dakota Utilities for authority to increase rates of natural gas service. Questions before the Commission. Shall the Commission suspend the imposition of the tariff for 90 days beyond April 23rd? And shall the Commission assess a filing fee for actual expenses not to exceed $100,000? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dave Gerdes.
Didn't know if that clock had been changed yet.
Doesn't look like it, does it?
Good evening.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I think it has been changed. I think you started an hour later. good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dave Gerdes. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I represent Montana Dakota Utilities Company. We take no position on staff's request.
Thank you.
Thank you. In other words, we don't oppose it since it's what usually is done.
Any questions? Staff.
Thank you, Chairman. These are the normal actions that the commission staff is requesting, and we would just recommend approval of the
items. Thank you, Dave. Is there a motion by the
commission? Mr. Chairman, I move that the commission suspend the imposition of the tariff for 90 days and assess a filing fee for actual expenses not to exceed $100,000.
And I second.
And I concur. Telecommunications, the items 1 and 2. If there is no objection from the other commissioners, items 1 and 2 will be moved to the end of today's agenda. Item 3 is TC04-260 in the matter of the application of Budget Phone Incorporated for a certificate of authority to provide inter-exchange telecommunication services and local exchange services in South Dakota. The question before the commission is, shall the commission grant a certificate of authority to Budget Phone Incorporated? Mr. Singer.
Thank you. On December 14th of 2004, Budget Phone Incorporated filed an application for a certificate of authority to provide inter-exchange and local exchange services in South Dakota. The applicant has requested a waiver from filing financial statements as required by ARSD 2010-2402 Part 8 and 2010-3203 Part 11. The applicant has provided a $25,000 bond. And with that, I would recommend that the commission grant the waiver request and issue Budget Phone Incorporated a local exchange and inter-exchange authority subject to rural safeguards and with a continuing bond requirement.
Yes, questions. Go ahead, John.
I'm just wondering, Mr. Singer, on this one, the exemption that they requested is a little different than we usually have. Do you want to address that? What are we talking about there, areas where there's cable deployment?
Well, my understanding are you referring to the rules, what I refer to as the rural safeguard
right.
exemption? It's my understanding that that does not apply to cable. If there's cable TV can
what I'm getting at is normally it says within Quest territory, and this appears to encompass more than that, potentially. And what are we talking about, like Webster and Wabe, where we have ITC deploying its own cable facilities? Is that what that is? And I'm not trying to hold things up here. I'm just curious.
To be honest with you, I took that as just being the Quest, and that when the companies file these, they file group. So I'll be honest, I do not have an answer to your question.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other questions by the commission? If not, is there a motion on item 3? I will move to grant the COA for Budget Phone Incorporated.
Second.
I concur.
Motion carries. Yes.
Do we need a motion to waive the filing of financial information? Is that not required?
If you want to amend your motion, I think we just say, normally what we say is pursuant to staff's recommendations, and that covers it all and make sure the commissioners get it right. So I don't know if you want to restate or...
I'm sure that was part of my motion, but I'll restate it. I move that the commission grant a certificate of authority to Budget Phone Incorporated according to staff's recommendations.
And I'll second.
I'll concur.
Motion carries. TC05-048 in the matter of the filing for approval of an amendment to an interconnection agreement between Quest Corporation and McLeod USA Telecommunications Services Incorporated. The question before the commission is, shall the commission approve the amendment? And appearing before us today is Karen.
Thank you. I'm taking this matter from Ms. Graff. Quest is on the phone. I don't know if they have any comment on this one.
I think that was there a response from Quest?
This is Melissa Thompson. Called in on staff. Quest does not have any comments on this.
Thank you.
Thank you. The amendment was properly filed and executed. It does not appear to contain any discriminatory language. No comments were filed. and staff would recommend approval.
Thank you. Are there any questions? If not, is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we approve the amendment.
Second.
Concur. Motion carries. Item 5, TC05-049, in the matter of the filing for approval of a master services agreement between Quest Corporation and Lightyear Network Solutions, LLC. We will take these two separately, even though they are shown together. The first item, staff. Karen, are you handling that?
Yes, I am. Thank you. Lightyear does not have a local exchange authority, a COA, with us. And when Ms. Gruff talked to them, apparently they don't plan on submitting an application for a COA in the near future either. So, therefore, staff would recommend disapproval.
Thank you. Is there anyone representing Lightyear? If not, is there a motion by the commission?
I have a question first. Why their unwillingness to file us for a COA?
And I don't know this for sure, but I'm guessing they're probably rolling out over a number of states at a time, and they weren't going to be filing in South Dakota for 6 to 8 months, and we don't want to sit on it for that long until they get a certificate, if they do. So they will just refile when they get their certificate.
Does Lightyear understand? I mean, have they been explained that this is going to be staff's recommendation?
Yes. Sarah talked to Alinda Hunt at Lightyear.
With that, I would move that the commission deny the filing.
Second.
I concur. The second item under number 5 is TC05-050 in the matter of the filing for approval of an adoption agreement between Quest Corporation and KMC Data, LLC. The question is, shall the commission approve this agreement? Karen.
Thank you. I spoke to Ms. Andrea Pruitt-Edmonds this morning from KMC, and she had just gotten the motion from Quest and all of that. So I don't believe she was able to join us on the phone. She did not think she would be able to. That being the case, I would recommend deferral.
Questions? Is there anyone on the phone to represent either KMC or Quest on this item?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Melissa Thompson from Quest. I would support staff recommendation.
It sounds that you stated you support staff's recommendation.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Is there a motion to not approve?
I'll move to defer action on this item.
All right.
I will second.
And I concur. Item number 6 is to review implementation of FCC requirements for Lifeline and Link-Up programs and the development of additional outreach efforts. The question before the commission is, shall the commission open a docket or conduct some other type of proceeding regarding these matters? Mr. Coit, are you... You wish to be first.
I can go first. This is Rolaine Weiss. Yes. Staff filed this a letter with the commission in requesting that the commission consider opening a docket or conducting some other type of proceeding regarding the Lifeline and Link-Up programs. And this all relates with the FCC's revisions of their Lifeline Link-Up program, where they added new eligibility requirements as well as certification and verification procedures. And staff believes it would be beneficial for the commission to review how the companies, the ETCs, are implementing the new eligibility, the certification, and the verification requirements. In addition, I think the commission could explore with other agencies whether it would be possible to develop a system to allow ETCs access to other agencies' databases of low-income assistance program participants or income reports. That would be with respect to their new certification requirements by the FCC. And the FCC has also encouraged the states to work with the companies on developing additional outreach efforts. And I think the commission could do that, with a possible outcome being that perhaps the commission would develop specific advertising rules that could apply to ETCs. And I would also ask if any of the other companies that are listening in or in the room have any comments on this request.
Thank you. Rich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, commissioners, and staff. Ms. Wiest and I have talked for quite a while about these new requirements, trying to recall when the actual order came out. I think it was, sometime last fall?
Yes, I think so.
And the requirements themselves are subject to a couple of different timelines in terms of implementation. The new eligibility requirements themselves went into effect, I think, probably 30 days after the FCC order was published. But there are some additional requirements dealing with certification of, or I should say verification of subscribers, whether they're appropriately receiving Lifeline and LinkUp discounts. And those requirements are not actually scheduled to take effect until, I think, June 22nd of this year. So I do think that this docket is timely. I support the request to open a docket for a couple of reasons. Right now, if we look at what the companies, at least the SDTA member companies, are doing in Lifeline and LinkUp, in terms of outreach, probably in particular, it does vary. Some certainly are probably a little bit more aggressive than others in terms of consumer outreach, which causes me some concern. The FCC has certainly has a desire, and rightly so, to make sure that Lifeline and LinkUp is being offered in a way that most of the people that are qualified, or all of the people that are qualified, are in a position to receive the discounts. So I think that because of the FCC oversight and the fact that I know in some states, and I'm not sure what the status is here, but they've actually engaged in some audits of companies to see what the companies are doing. I think it would be helpful to the companies that are charged with implementing Lifeline and LinkUp to have some guidelines in terms of consumer outreach. So that's one area where I think this is important. The other thing where I think Ms. Weiss mentioned the fact that there may be some possibility of sharing some records or information on consumers. We are required under the new rules to engage annually in a process of some sort of we're supposed to come up with a plan. Each LEC is supposed to come up with a plan to verify some random sampling of customers to determine whether those customers, or at least a segment of the customers, continue to be eligible. When people fill out the forms for Lifeline and LinkUp, they give indication on the form that they're eligible based on their participation in certain government programs, or now based on some income guidelines. And there's nothing really that has been in place to take people off of a system when they're not eligible. They're no longer eligible. So there is now a requirement that LECs and the companies that are offering Lifeline and LinkUp start some verification process that occurs annually to study customers or sample customers. And there is little direction in the FCC rules on how that should occur. And I think that's another reason for this docket. I have received a lot of questions from companies about, well, what should we do? How should we proceed with this? And we've tried to give some guidance based on what the rules say. And we've given some ideas in terms of how they may want to go about sampling. But I do think that that's something the commission should look at. And one of the things that's come up there is, there's a fine line between making sure that the individuals continue to be eligible and undertaking this study process or this sampling process and driving people away from the program. And I think that if there is a good plan that meets that balance or is making sure that we meet our requirements under the FCC rules in terms of ensuring verification, but it doesn't become inconvenient for customers or burdensome to customers. I think that's the critical thing, and if there's some way we can actually share information with some of the state agencies that have some of the qualifying assistance programs, that would eliminate the need to contact certain customers directly and ask for them to come down to the office and sign another form or provide information. So in any event, we do support this process.
Thank you, Rich. Is there anyone else on the line who would like to share thoughts on this item with the commission?
I think there's a gentleman in the back room who would like to come.
Is there anyone else on the line?
This is Carol Rosenberg from Quest. And I just wanted to respond to the position Quest is currently at in regards to implementing the FCC's orders on that document, which was last June. Basically, at that time, we did implement the two new program criteria. When the order went into effect, those were to go into effect immediately. The National School Lunch Program and the Temporary Assistance to Needy Family was added to the South Dakota program in June of last year. And then the FCC order gave ETCs up to 12 months to implement the third criteria, which was the income eligibility, because along with adding that criteria was and process changes for collecting the documentation from customers and being able to store that for the life of the time that they are on tap. We are prepared and are planning at this point, the week of April 25th, we will have our new South Dakota enrollment brochures going forward, which do also give customers the opportunity to enroll in TAP based on whether they're at 135% of the federal poverty guidelines, and gives them clear instructions on what information they need to send in with their application to support that that income level, like income tax forms or different things like that, which were laid out by the FCC. Sending that piece of it in April 25th, and between now and June, we are also putting into process our first verification. Again, as the gentleman ahead of me spoke to, the FCC did lay out that it was the ETC's responsibility in default states, such as South Dakota, to do an annual verification, and we could do that either by sampling a group of customers and then taking them to the various state agencies to see if they were still enrolled in the program, or sending a letter directly to those customers asking them to re-verify. We've chosen the latter because there's a variety of programs they could have initially signed in under, and we don't necessarily know what they signed in as their program, so trying to track down the agencies, it seems easier at this point in time to directly correspond with a sample of the customers, and in future years when those customers sign up based on income, again, there wouldn't necessarily be an agency that had ever been involved with the customer. They could just strictly have been low income, signed up themselves, so we wouldn't be able to verify with an agency. So we're preparing at this point to move forward with the random sample and process that the FCC laid out, and we are looking to send those letters out before the June 22nd date. And to the third point of outreach, as far as getting the information to customers who are likely to qualify, we are really anxious, and I think the FCC put out several guidelines. I don't see the need for additional guidelines, but we would love to see the state take a role perhaps in bringing the various ETCs together so we might put out a consistent program within the state. And what one's doing is similar to what another's doing. I think the guidelines are there, but some coordination might be helpful, and that's what we would look forward to.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, good morning. David LaFiore on behalf of RCC Minnesota and Wireless Alliance. Not an ETC in this state yet, of course, but certainly hope to be in the future. And I just wanted to echo the statements of both of the prior folks who spoke here and add one very brief comment, and that is RCC and some of the other clients I've represented are in a number of states around the country, and our experience has been that states who play an active role in making available to carriers the data of people who are eligible on the rolls or assist in some way in helping to participate with those outreach efforts have been very effective and have made it much easier on the carriers, and it has benefited consumers a lot. For example, there's one state that has a list of everybody who is participating in these programs, and they just sent out directly a postcard to each one of them that says, you know, if since you're in one of these programs, you are eligible for discounted telephone service, and here are the companies in the state that provide it. You may want to contact one of them to find out if they provide service in your area. Some of them are a little more detailed, some a little less detailed, but in the areas where the states have kind of grabbed onto this and coordinated databases, it has worked very well.
Thank you very much. Questions by any of the commissioners? John?
Maybe this is Rolaine or Rich or David. I don't know. In terms of what kind of proceeding you'd like to see, is what you envision here a rulemaking proceeding or an investigative type docket, or what are you looking at? What do you want us to do, I guess?
Yeah, at this point, I would just prefer that the commission open a docket, and it wouldn't be a contested case type docket. But technically, at this point, it's not a rulemaking either. It could lead to a rulemaking, but it would be for the purpose of getting the information, you know, assembled into one place. And I think the first step would be to ask for the companies to file, to tell us what their certification and verification plans are and give us copies of their Lifeline link-up forms to review. But I wouldn't want I don't think it's any type of contested case proceeding. More of an informational proceeding or investigative proceeding.
Thank you.
How would we phrase that in order to be as encompassing as necessary? Something along the line is the commission opening up a docket to review how ETCs are implementing the new FCC requirements, obtaining information regarding certification, verification process, and review how ETCs are advertising the availability of these programs to their customers.
Yes, I think that would encompass both our review of their materials and the outreach effort that we would like to develop more fully.
Is there anything? Obviously, I can't imagine I articulated it exactly the way one should. But
I think that's correct, though. I think it's mainly the FCC's procedures to see how they've been implemented and to look at the outreach efforts.
All right. I'll make a motion, unless there's some other questions by the council, commission. Make a motion that the commission open up a docket to review how eligible telecommunication carriers are implementing the new FCC requirements and how they obtain information regarding the certification verification process, and that the commission review how ETCs are advertising the availability of these programs to their customers, and whether the commission should approve additional assistance in outreach efforts.
Second.
I'm happy to concur with such a well-worded motion.
Motion carries. Item 7, Quest Performance Assurance Plan Audit. Today, shall the Commission join the Regional Collaborative to handle the auditing of Quest Performance Assurance Plans. Harlan. Who's handling it?
I can take this. It's Rolaine Wiest. We would like the Commission to open up or to join the Regional Collaborative in this case. We can't give you specific numbers at this time because how many states are there that have joined so far? Harlan?
Presently, there are 8 states that have affirmatively joined.
Right. And so with us, it would be 9, and they're looking for 13 states. At this point, if all 13 states joined, this first go-around for the audit would cost around $40,000. It's my understanding that under the Tier 2, which is the money that comes to the commission and is split up into the two separate funds, the discretionary funds and the special fund, that half of, we have about $200,000 in that, and or $212,000. Half of that would actually be in the special fund, and the special fund was specifically set up to help pay for this audit, and I think a regional approach would certainly be cheaper than doing it on our own. And what I would like is just the commission to vote to join the Regional Collaborative with the condition that we are successful in setting up our accounts to receive the money from Quest. And I think we would just limit it at this point to this first go-round. It's possible that there could be further audits down the road, but I think we should just we should probably just wait until they know what they're going to do with the second phase and join this first phase, because they do have Liberty Consulting lined up.
Thank you. Does anyone have anything additional to that? If not, Commission action.
Mr. Chairman, I'd make a motion to join the regional collaborative on the condition that we're successful in setting up the accounts to receive the money from Quest.
I'll second it, and I'd just like to say that, you know, in the past, this has been a very good format, and it's worked very well, and I think resulted in pretty significant cost savings for the state of South Dakota.
And I will concur. Motion carries. We will take up items telecommunications 1 and 2 at this time. We have a stenographer for both of those items, or just one of those items? All right. So just to remind folks, there hasn't been any one talking over each other or anything of that nature up to this juncture, but just to remind folks that we will have stenographers. Item 1, TC03-193, in the matter of the filing by RCC Minnesota Incorporated and Wireless Alliance, LLC, doing business as Unicell, for designation as an eligible telecommunications carrier. The question before the commission is, the commission shall hear oral arguments. There's no question.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, if the chair would be willing, I would request we take up TC04225 before taking up TC04. Excuse me, what is the there's a number on there. Before we take up TC03193.
That request will be honored. Item number 2, TC04-225, in the matter of the filing by VCI Company for designation as an eligible telecommunications carrier. Today, shall the Commission enter an order designating VCI Company as an ETC for its requested ETC service area, and shall the Commission provide a certification to the Federal Communications Commission and to the Universal Service Administration Company regarding the plan for the use of Federal Universal Services support?
If I may, this is Karen Kramer of staff. I believe that Malia, I won't even try to pronounce her last name, from VCI, is on the phone. And this is an ETC. It's different from the RCC, in that RCC is rural and wireless, and this one is wireline and in the Quest territory. But if for some reason you want to, the conditions that have come out of that FCC order, if you would want to apply those to VCI, or if you want to wait until you've heard the arguments in RCC to make a determination, you can hear from VCI, but, you know, you could always defer this matter if need be. I didn't want you to have people arguing that FCC order in this VCI docket, because nobody's really prepared to do that where they are prepared in your RCC docket.
Ms. Tossi, do you have anything to add?
Stan Efferding here from VCI, president of VCI Company. Ms. Tossi, not on the line. I don't know that I have anything to add. I think that she's accurately described that we work as a wireline carrier in non-rural locations.
Could I have your name again, please, sir?
Stan Efferding. E-F-F-E-R-D-I-N-G.
Thank you. And so you're saying you would like this deferred until after we hear the other one?
I don't have an opinion on that. I'm certainly willing to wait to hear the other argument. Do we just provide low-income pipeline and link-up services? Our experience, we're currently providing that in about 8 other states, and our experience is that the new FCC order has not been perceived to impact our business.
All right. Thank you. Karen?
And I believe he is correct. It was just, I didn't know, you know, if for some reason you were going to start applying those standards across the board to all ETCs, you know, if theirs came up first, and like I said, they're really not prepared to address all that. But we could hear this, you know, hear staff's recommendation and see what the commission wants to do. You could always defer it.
Thank you. Then I was going to go to Harlan, but if you have something to... Staff?
I can just take that, Harlan, if you don't have anything. We've reviewed the application. The only thing that Mr. Efferding, that we were waiting to receive from you, and I had talked to Malia about this before, was, and it might be you have since sent it and we just haven't received it yet, the advertising that they're looking to do, I don't know, a sample or a letter was given to the commissioners and council. They plan on advertising on TV, and they gave us the website, and I went out and listened to it, and you know, truth be told, more people probably watch TV and would pick up their 800 number and would see their advertisement that way than through a newspaper or white page ads or anything like that. I have asked them to send a sample of written advertising if they use any written advertisement in other states. And then they needed to update their tariff as to who is eligible for Lifeline Link-Up. They did not have – they had it right in the tribal area, but needed to add TANF and the school lunch program and then the 135% income eligibility at some point. And then I'm just waiting to get a certificate of service from them that shows that they did provide a copy of this to all the other providers in the Quest territory. So – you could approve it with those conditions. You could defer it until they get us a copy of those couple of things.
Thank you. Other questions by the commission?
Ms. Kramer, what would be your preference, to defer action until that information is in hand, or?
That would be my preference. I know the company would like to move forward, but I really think we would have it by the April 26th meeting. And that way staff would have an opportunity. Oh, I know the other thing that I'm waiting for is a service agreement, a sample of the service agreement. I would just like to be able to review those and give them any suggestions if need be before that time. Or, like I said, you could condition the approval on us getting those matters and them being acceptable.
Mr. Efferding, Commissioner Johnson here, would that provide an undue burden on VCI?
I don't believe it would. We've experienced both cases where we've been given conditional approval currently in California. They're reviewing the very same items that you mentioned because these do change. As we were afforded a conditional approval and then submitted these items later. I don't know that we're prepared to enter that market within the next 30 days, so I don't think it would be an undue burden.
Thank you very much.
Well, especially if we're waiting on some information and staff feels the need to review it and that we've heard from the company that it shouldn't be anything that's unduly burdensome. And in fact, we have a commission meeting scheduled for 2 weeks. In light of all of that, I would move that we defer the matter until the April 26th Public Utilities Commission meeting.
I'm sorry.
Excuse me.
Before there's a final vote, could I just ask a few questions of the company at this time in case they need to provide any more information?
Please.
And this is Rolaine Wiesta, General Counsel with the Commission. And going back to your advertising, Mr. Efferding, I was looking through it, and it didn't appear to actually advertise the benefits available on tribal lands when I looked at that specific advertising.
That's correct. In some states, the non-rural areas don't have any tribal land, so we're careful not to, and that's a generic commercial that you saw. Some states, there are tribal lands in rural areas, and therefore we have to add that information. We do provide, as required by the FCC, the tribal land discounts.
And you do provide advertising?
Correct.
For tribal lands in commercials?
In commercials, yeah. We have a threefold process where we run commercials on television. We put bill inserts in all of our bills that go out each month. We also send brochures to all of the social services offices.
And then looking at your advertisement, it doesn't appear to advertise LinkUp, just Lifeline.
You're correct. You're correct. LinkUp and Lifeline are, if you qualify for Lifeline, you qualify for LinkUp. And then that's promoted to the consumer when they call in. The discounts are in the tariff. The consumers extended those benefits at the time of call-in.
And then you stated you provide wireline services primarily through UNEs. Is there any other way that you provide it?
The UNEs are the only ones that qualify for the discount. some areas where fees are cost prohibitive and will provide resold bot service, but those aren't eligible for the federal discount.
Right. And I think you also asked for certification, is that correct?
I believe so.
And then maybe I should direct this to staff. Have they complied with our requirements about putting in the amount of money that they expect to get, or would the certification requirements that we have put on in the other companies, the money that they would, are they expecting to get any high-cost money and how they're going to spend that money? I mean, generally, before we do certification, we ask all the companies to provide that information. And I thought maybe they'd just provided it to staff. That might be something you guys might want to think about, since it looks like they're asking for certification also. And then you also stated that in your petition that the benefit of the public interest statement is that who qualify by lowering their telephone bills. What are your rates?
The rate that we'll move forward with is $14 a month. We'll advertise on television. Basic monthly service, unlimited local dial tone.
Okay.
Regarding your question on the high cost, low income, the FCC does not distinguish, once the state has determined ETC status, the FCC doesn't distinguish between the two. Generally, we have to communicate at a local level to the states the message that we're not pursuing high cost. Where territories have rural areas included in them, we've actually signed waivers with the rural
Would leaders. You hold on for a moment, please?
Sure.
I am just missing you a little bit. I want to make sure that I'm getting everything.
Our stenographer is challenged just a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, could we go off the record for a minute, and
sure.
I'll give you, Sherry a chance to catch up. My daughter is undergoing some medical tests right now. My wife has to get into work. So I have a pending motion, and Mr. Chairman, if you see fit and still appropriate to defer it, I certainly encourage staff to continue their line of questioning. I think it's appropriate, but I really do need to go and be part of that. I will have the opportunity, though, because we're taking a transcript, to read the arguments that are going to be made in the last item that we're going to take up this morning. So rest assured, I will take a very careful look at those. Hopefully I can get back in time to be part of that process, but unfortunately this is one of these things where family comes first. So please excuse me for stepping on the hearing.
And I will hold your motion. That's why I haven't called it out of order. Ruled it without a second, so we'll maintain that until. Sherry, are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready. Sir, this is the court reporter, and I was just losing you there a little bit. You said we have to communicate at the local level between the states the message that we're not
pursuing high-cost funding and will not attempt to serve
All right.
on non-rural areas.
Are we ready to go back on the record? Okay, we're back on the record, and, sir, if you would like to continue where you left off. Mr. Chardin?
I got
the wrong one. Efforting.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I concluded that.
All right. Thank you.
I guess maybe I'm just missing something. Quest, with respect to high-cost funding, Quest is available for some high-cost funding, even though it's a non-rural. Would you be requesting that money? You're not requesting any non-rural high-cost fund money?
No.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, there is a motion before us to defer. I will second the motion.
I concur.
The motion carries. We're back to item number one, which is TC03-193. I will restate the information pertaining to that in the matter of the filing by RCC Minnesota Incorporated and Wireless Alliance LLC, doing business as Unicell for designation as an eligible telecommunications carrier, and the commission will hear oral arguments this time. Mr. Weisort.
If I may, Commissioner, I'm just going to rehand out what's been marked as an exhibit. It's not new. It was the Bruce Exhibit B to the rebuttal testimony because might refer to it during testimony rather than have you
dig through it if you brought the record, or if you didn't bring all your whole records, you have it in front of you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, David LaFuria here on behalf of RCC Minnesota and Wireless Alliance. We just had a brief discussion with Council for Interveners before starting, and just wanted to understand a couple ground rules. Do you want the proponent, that is RCC, to go first in the argument? And because I guess the question that was raised by interveners was they made the motion originally to reopen the record and add additional material, consider the most recent FCC order. And I wanted to be sure that you had an opportunity to conduct this in the proper order that you wanted. And also, I wanted to get some sense of how much time you'd like from each of us, if you have time limits, or because if you did, I'd set aside some time for rebuttal if we were going first. And just wanted to get the ground rules.
Well, thank you very much for the question. We're comfortable with going either way. We will want to be certain that each side has ample opportunity to answer whatever questions are brought forth by the others during the process. So if you wish to go first, that's fine with me. If you've made other arrangements with Mr. Coit or someone else, then that's fine as well.
I think if the oral argument includes, and I'm prepared to talk about it as obviously as much as you wish, but if it includes oral argument on the merits of the case as well as the recent FCC order, then I'd prefer that we go first. If you wish to limit us just to the recent motion, it might be more appropriate for Mr. Coit to go first since he made the motion.
Mr. Chairman, I think we just want to have it with the FCC order and not the merits of the case. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Then I would defer to the interveners, as since they made the motion. I think that's what we agreed on.
Roland, is that?
Oh, well, I guess it was my understanding that the oral arguments were really, that could be anything with respect to the case. I mean, I do have questions that relate not just to the FCC's newest order.
Well, that'd be fine by me. I mean,
we're off the record now for a while. Okay.
I think we'll probably be prepared to answer any
sure.
question, probably 9 out of 10, and then the one we might have to come back on one or two, but I
okay.
think we're ready.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. LaFleur.
Mr. LaFleur, you're going to be first. And when you're ready, then we will be on the record.
Okay. I think I'm okay.
It's up to the parties. If they only want to address the FCC, that's fine. But I didn't think it was necessarily limited just to the FCC's most recent order. So it's up to the parties.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Johnson, good morning. David LaFuria for RCC Minnesota and Wireless Alliance, who are the petitioners in this case. I am going to confine my remarks to the FCC's recent FCC, what I call the FCC ETC order, and obviously I'm happy to take any questions that you or the general counsel may have that pertain to any aspect of the case. We generally prepared for that, and I expect that we should be able to give you appropriate responses. By now, you hopefully have seen our briefing paper, which we filed yesterday in this matter, responding to the intervener's request and opening brief. I think that with respect to this ETC order, this is a fairly simple analysis. First of all, it appears that the parties do agree that the FCC's ETC order is not binding on state ETC designation cases. That is, we do not have a change of law here in South Dakota as a result of the FCC's ETC designation order. What the ILECs have requested is that this commission apply those FCC guidelines immediately in this case to this applicant. The far better course is for this commission to conduct a rulemaking pursuant to which all interested parties in this state can participate and determine whether the guidelines that the FCC has set forth are appropriate here in South Dakota. I think the FCC has made very clear that states retain the authority to conduct public interest analyses, and I think there's no question, if you look at the statute, Congress delegated to this commission the ability to make those determinations. And therefore, I could tell you why, and we don't need to get that far in this oral argument, I could tell you why certain of the FCC guidelines would be appropriate and other of the guidelines might not be appropriate here in South Dakota. And surely, if you heard from ILEX and CLEX and cable companies and other wireless carriers who are not participating here today, you would get additional views, probably better views than I have, quite frankly. And what that would give you is the ability to look at all of the viewpoints, distill down what you think is best for this state, and issue rules that then everyone would be required to abide by, including RCC if it were designated here. I think fundamentally, as a legal matter, since we don't have a change of facts, what we only have is a potential change of law and one which amounts only to guidelines, RCC really does deserve a decision based on the record as it stands today, based on the law as it stands today. I also need to point out one thing that we managed to leave out of our briefing papers yesterday, and I think it was included in the ILEX brief, and quite frankly, we overlooked it in the drafting process, and that is, if the decision of this commission is to follow the game plan that the FCC has put into place, I'd suggest you look carefully at this new rule, which is not yet effective, but will be soon, probably at the end of May, Section 54202. And Section B of that section, it's very short, let me read it. It says, any common carrier that has been designated under Section 214E6, which is by the FCC, as an ETC, or that has submitted its application for designation before the effective date of these rules, must submit the information required by paragraph A of this section no later than October 1, 2006, as part of its annual reporting requirements. It's very important to understand what the FCC has done here. What they've said is these rules are going to be effective, let's say, May 30th. It's a guess, but it's an approximate date. Every application that's pending at the FCC, including one that RCC has pending over there in the state of New Hampshire and a bunch of others, and anybody who files an ETC petition before, let's call it May 30th of this year, is going to be judged under the law that's in effect today. All of these additional reporting requirements and public interest qualification criteria are not going to apply to those petitions. The reason is pretty simple. The commission does not want to go about reopening the record for each one of them, taking supplements, additional arguments, additional briefing. They want to decide these cases on the record as they stand. They want to move them forward, and anybody who becomes an ETC is going to have roughly a year and a half to get in place all of the requirements. Anybody who doesn't want to abide by those requirements can withdraw their ETC petition, or if they become an ETC and later on figure out that they can't do it, they can withdraw as an ETC. I think this is clearly the better way to go, and if the interveners believe that running the FCC's game plan is the way to go, then my advice is then run it all the way and give us a decision under the law as it currently stands. The other problem that I have with applying new standards here is that Section 253 of the Act requires that all new requirements and all universal service rules be applied in a competitively neutral fashion. I think it's going to be pretty hard for the Commission in this proceeding to determine whether RCC should be designated to impose new requirements, which it then must consider how to apply them in a competitively neutral fashion to ILEX and other ETCs in this state. I mean, that's not what this case is about. I could pull out, for example, a five-year plan. At some point, this commission would have to look at that in this case and say, okay, if we're going to do that here, what are we going to do for the ILEX? What are we going to do for the other ETCs? And this is clearly not the place to be making those decisions. I think to conclude, RCC would like a decision right away. It's ready to go. It's got four new cell sites on the drawing board with the first year support that it projects that it's going to get. The consumers out there will clearly benefit if this construction happens now rather than later. RCC's petition has been pending since November of 2003. Consumers in that area would already be getting service if this petition had been acted on a year. And if we do additional proceedings and this drags out towards the end of the year, the construction that RCC committed to this commission back in October of last year that it would complete in 2005 clearly will not get, could not possibly get done if the proceeding continues on. So I think that the best course of action is to designate RCC under the law that we have in place, move them forward, conduct a rulemaking within the year, and determine what's best for South Dakota, develop those processes in accordance with the comments from all interested parties, and then apply them to everyone. And RCC is going to have to abide by whatever you put into place. I'd like an opportunity to rebut if that's possible, but I thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Yes, Mr. Lane, we've had some questions. I think staff brought this up in their first brief, and the question is, you know, designating both RCC Minnesota and Wireless Alliance in both areas. And so my question specifically is, what would be the problem if this commission were to designate RCC Minnesota in the Northeast and Wireless Alliance in the Southeast? I mean, would that cause any problems for you guys?
Would it be two different designation orders, or would it be one designation order with two captions?
It could be in the same order or not. I don't know. I would assume it would probably be in the same order.
Operationally, I don't believe having two different designations is going to be a problem for the company. I mean, I'm assuming, of course, that the requirements are going to be identical. They run this network in the state generally with the same operational procedures, and also they're not going to have – I don't see any disconnects operationally as a result of doing that. Legally, I'm trying to recall if any other state has done it this way. I don't think that they have, but I don't think that if you had two separate designations and sent two separate certifications up to the FCC, for example, that it would create a problem for the commission. I think that the only thing I can think of is that you've got two separate service areas here, and as I understand, one designation for the entire state, it would give RCC flexibility in its planning. For example, if there were a spike in demand, let's say, in the southern area of the Wireless Alliance area. Admittedly, I'm speculating a little bit now, but I want you to consider this. At this rate, they're only going to receive in the first year like $1.5 million, and so that might be, at best, four or five cell sites max. If there were a sudden spike in demand in the lower portion of this, and they made a determination operationally in 1 year, the best use of those funds is that they're getting a lot of requests for service. We ought to build down here more quickly because that's where people are really complaining that they need more service right away. If they wanted to allocate all of their funds to that lower portion, I think they ought to be able to. They should be allowed to. I think if you do two designations, they may well find themselves in a spot where there are funds solely for Wireless Alliance down here and solely for RCC up here, and it may impair their ability to move the way they want to build out these areas. So in that respect, I think you'd be better off with one designation. It is how other states have done it. Other than that, I can't think of another thing that would be really operationally important to them.
Okay, thank you. That was helpful. And then I just wanted to make sure that I have all the areas straight, and I don't know if you do have your Exhibit 4 at all.
I do have on my laptop, I have the brief that we filed.
Right, and I just want to get this straight. For Exhibit C, and that's where you want immediate designation.
Yes, I'm following.
Okay. Would it be correct that the Alliance Communications Cooperative, those would be taken off? RCC Communications, Roberts County, Stockholm, Strandberg stay on, and Union Telephone and Valley Telephone are added? Because those would be the ones that you want immediate designation for?
This would probably be the question I couldn't answer until I went back and looked.
Okay, you can just double-check that. But it appears that, Union Telephone and Valley were on the other ones, but I think maybe you realized that you were really going to serve the entire area within South Dakota, and so it's my understanding that you're putting them on Exhibit C. And I believe Alliance is coming out because they're actually, Hudson and Elcester is part of the other. They're not real. It was one study area as opposed to, or two study areas as opposed to one that you were originally thinking
yes.
of?
I believe that you're correct, but without our brief that I have on my laptop is only the list of wire centers that we wanted in and out. It doesn't include this part.
Right.
Of it. So I'm not able to tell you with absolute certainty that that's correct.
You can just double check that and get, okay. I mean, it's all in the record. I just want to make sure I have it correct.
Okay.
And the other thing that, and this might be just so, I might be missing something, but in your brief where you listed all of the wire centers that, you know, I think this would be under option two, I'll call it.
Yes.
I didn't see the ITC Raymond Exchange on that list. Did I just miss something there? Was that changed somehow at the hearing? In your brief. It is on Exhibit D.
Tell me which one it is again. ITC
Raymond? ITC Raymond Exchange. Is it in your brief? When you listed it, you know, all the ones that you would serve under option two.
Again, I'll have to check.
If you just want to double check that for me, and there could be a reason for that, I'm just missing it. And then I was, does RCC, there was talk about the local usage plans. Does RCC, do you have any unlimited local usage plans?
Yes. And okay. I would answer it this way. You know, we have a record that it contains RCC's local usage plans as of the date it filed. And then I think there was a supplement that was in May of 2004, and we discussed that at the hearing. And I think part of RCC's testimony was, you know, we have this variety of local usage plans, and we have what we have in the record today. But as time goes on, the company in a competitive marketplace continues to develop new rate plans and add them. So as of today, they both Wireless Alliance in the lower end and RCC at the top, as of today, do have unlimited local usage plans that offer a large local calling area and unlimited calling throughout their footprints. However, I can't say to you for certain that the plan that they have that's being actively promoted today is the same that it was back in May, because the company does continue to work to provide these services and offer consumers, I mean, in wireless, the prices are going down and the value is going up. So I can't say for certain that it's precisely the same as what we have in the record today, but it is there. It is unlimited. It's still going on.
Okay. And then going to my question on that rule, and I read your brief very carefully, you know, 2010-32-42. I guess I'm not sure if my question is still answered, but maybe it's because I just don't understand your option one yet. But my understanding of your option one is that each for the ones that you don't serve all, you know, the entire Exhibit D, the exchanges on Exhibit D, you're asking that the commission redefine those rural LECs down to the wire center, correct?
So that each wire center is a separate ILEC service area.
Is a separate ILEC service area, right. And then under option one, I'll call it, what you are also requesting is that with respect to the let's say that happened. They are redefined down to the individual wire centers. With respect to the wire centers that are not entirely within RCC service area, you only serve part of that wire center.
Correct.
You are requesting that RCC be designated as RCC's ETC service area just for that part in that's within your service area and not for the entire wire center.
You've got it precisely correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So
I say that knowing that this application was filed in November of 2003 and that a number of other states have designated in that fashion. And most recently in this FCC ETC order, the FCC approved petitions for redefinition, or I should say they concurred, because they don't really have a right to approve. They concurred with petitions that came from states that had done it this way on the theory that these were in the pipeline and these have been worked on for all this time. We're not going to upset the apple cart right now. But for future ETC applications, we think the FCC said, we think that the wire center should be the minimum area that a competitor is required to serve. And so we come to you now saying, I think that you could make the designation under option one. You could file a petition for redefinition with the FCC on those on that basis, and what we would what probably should be added to it is a statement that this application was filed well before the new FCC ETC order, and it should be processed in the same way. And I'm not certain, but I think the FCC would process it in that fashion because this has been pending for so long. The commission may go with option B and say we only want whole wire centers to be served, and if that's the place where the commission lands, that's why we've provided in our briefing papers the list of the wire centers that would be in it and would be out. And I would add just one last thing, and that is, you know, we had said there are several places in here where there's a wire center that overlaps into another state, and we want a designation in that portion that is served by South Dakota. And to the extent that that's still a question in your mind, I know we had briefed that several states and the FCC had designated for that portion that's within the state. And a recent decision, I think it was last week down in Texas, there's a Court of Appeals decision, or a Texas Court of Appeals decision, not a U.S., where the Texas Commission also said that that was appropriate, that, that the Texas Commission designate the portion of a wire center that's in Texas but not the part that's in Arkansas.
And so then it goes back again to that last sentence in that rule. And so under option one, your service areas would be different, and I'm not getting this mixed up with study areas. Your
right.
service areas would be different than the RLEX service areas
for
some of those exchanges.
Correct.
If we went with option one.
For ETC purposes, yes. That is, our ETC service area would be defined as coterminous with our FCC licensed area throughout the state. And under option two, our FCC ETC service area would be defined as the following ILEC wire centers with a list.
Right. And so how can we do option one with the part of this rule that says the commission may not find it be in the public interest if the provider requesting such designation is not offering its services coextensive with the rural company's service area, not study area? I mean, when you talked in your brief, you kept, I think, I wasn't even arguing that we couldn't define it down to the wire center.
Right.
My point is, the way that I look at the rule, it appears that your service areas have to be coextensive, and that's not what option one does.
Yes, absolutely. The way I read the rule is that the commission may not, and as I understand the word may, the commission has an option to do this. And I don't think it's required in that rule to have the service areas be coterminous. If you read the rule the way that I do, you can make this decision. And I think in our briefing papers, one of the things that we said was that, for example, there could be other reasons, and we could use cream skimming as an example. If the commission had evidence in the record and it had a real concern about that in an area, it could make a decision to say, gee, we have this concern, so we're not going to do this. But if the commission doesn't have that concern here, as a number of other states have found, as I read that rule, it may not redefine. It doesn't say it shall not redefine or it's prohibited or precluded from redefining. It just says it may not find that it wishes to redefine in that fashion.
Right. But I'm not talking about redefinition. I mean, I'm talking about service areas.
Okay.
More than just redefinition,
yes,
is my point.
I may have misspoke. The commission may not choose to define a competitor's ETC service area in a different way than an ILEC service area. But also it may decide to do so. I mean, I think that's why may was in there as opposed to it shall not or it is prohibited from.
Well, actually, when you deal with our LRC, they say that may not, they won't let you use shall not. You have to use may not because may not means shall not. But I guess, that's how it's done.
If that is the case and you land as a result on option two, again, that's fine with RCC. I also think there was a secondary argument that we had that talked about if you read that rule in conjunction with the other rules that talks about redefinition, I think you can still get to where we are. We just didn't press this point really that hard. I think that if you want to get there, you can get there. And I think if you look to consumers, the big question would be if half a dozen or a dozen wire centers were to come out of this picture, what is the result to consumers? I think if you focus on that, the answer is pretty simple. you're going to have areas where RCC is advertising, either by newspaper, radio, or TV, or whatever. And they're going to advertise the availability of Lifeline and LinkUp service. And you're going to have a customer who has a, let's say they have an RCC phone already, and they get this advertisement, and they're really excited about it. It's great, I get a discount. They come into RCC's store, and they say, I want Lifeline. Well, I'm sorry, you can't have it because you're in that part of the wire center where we're not eligible. And the customer says, but wait a second, all the other wireless companies have lousy service in this area. You're the only ones who really serve me well. I want your service. Well, I'm sorry, you can have it, but you're going to pay for it. You're not going to get the benefits of Lifeline and LinkUp. And that's why I think some of the states have come out on the side of, look, wherever you're designated, get those benefits out there. Let's not have consumers coming in from various areas where you're eligible to get high cost, perhaps. Or let's say it's an area where, you know, if it's an interior area, you might have a cell site that you build in an eligible area, and let's say the signal bleeds over into an area where you're ineligible, and customers over there just happen to get really good signal. They live on a little hilltop or wherever. Those customers are going to look at advertisements, and they're going to come in, and they're going to want service. And they're going to say, you guys serve us. And we're going to say, yeah, we have an FCC license to serve there. We provide you high-quality service, but we just can't give you the Lifeline. And that's why we've asked for option one primarily.
And just one last question. Staff, I know, I believe, reiterated its position that you should serve rural Beresford.
Yes.
Do you have any comments on that? Because when I look at it, if you take rural Beresford and the other one out of there, it actually lessens cream skimming, doesn't it? It goes down to almost a 1-to-1 ratio as opposed to a 2.3-to-1 ratio. Is it – oh.
We don't
basically, is it your position that you still would prefer under option two that rural Beresford be left out?
I'm not trying to push one way or the other.
I'm just saying that if it's a cream skimming concern,
right.
It appeared from your analyst position is that once you take out rural Beresford and the other exchange under option two, that actually lessened the cream skimming in the Prairie Wave.
Our view is I guess the proper answer is we're not really pushing it that hard either. But to be precise, you know, I don't believe cream skimming is an issue at all. I mean, I take a very hard line on that this is something that's completely within the ILEX to resolve, and they still have disaggregation options to do so. And we believe that no carrier, no competitor should ever receive a reward in the form of a subsidy for coming into a low-cost area. So I want to make that clear right at the outset. The ILEX have complete power to resolve those imbalances. We don't. In terms of rural Beresford, our position is, you know, if you designate throughout that area, we're happy with that because it solves the problem I just spoke to you about before about Lifeline and LinkUp and customers coming to us and being unhappy and potentially filing complaints. But if you take it out, that's fine too. If that's where the commission lands, we'll accept that. I mean, it's not a deal breaker in terms of the grant.
Thank you. That's all my questions.
Thank you very much. Did you have anything else you needed to add as a result of the questions?
No, I don't, Commissioners. Mr. Chairman, if I might have an opportunity for a short rebuttal. If
you will.
Thanks very much.
Mr. Coit.
Thank you for the record. My name is Richard Coit, and I am presenting the argument today not just on behalf of SDTA, who is one of the intervening parties, but also presenting this argument on behalf of the other interveners. I'm going to try to keep my comments somewhat brief. We covered our position pretty well in the brief that was filed, and I do not want to get into the same level of detail that we've included in the brief, of course. If we look at the petitioner's supplemental brief in this matter, they're approaching things as they have throughout this case, which is really to downplay, I think, the significance of the entire ETC designation process. This is something they've tried to do all along, and they have throughout this proceeding put more emphasis on competition and have really shied away from addressing in any realistic way the universal service concerns that are presented with multiple designations in high-cost areas. I think that this is probably reflected more than anything in the testimony of Don Wood that was submitted in this matter. From our reading of the testimony of Don Wood, it would appear that from RCC's perspective, there shouldn't be any limit at all on the number of ETCs that are designated in rural areas, in high-cost areas. And that would give some reason to question whether they truly are interested in addressing in a realistic way universal service concerns. They've stated in their supplemental brief that it would be inappropriate for the Commission to apply the newly established standards to this case, which would effectively require a reopening of the record if RCC chooses to further pursue ETC designation. I think it's pretty clear if you look at those new requirements and you look at the current record, the record is not sufficient to satisfy all of those requirements. And we've noted in our brief specifically four of the new requirements that we feel are not adequately addressed by the current record. We disagree with the idea that the Commission cannot apply those standards. And for a number of reasons, we believe that the Commission should apply the standards. First, from day one in this proceeding, RCC and this Commission have known that the ETC designation standards that are applied by the FCC, which have consistently been applied by this Commission in past state designation proceedings, were in the process of change. The FCC commenced its process of reviewing the ETC designation standards and the requirements back in June of 2002. At that time, it issued an ETC referral order asking the Joint Board to look at certain issues regarding the ETC designation process. The Joint Board followed with its recommendations of, in February of 2004, and then finally, the action has culminated with this March 17th order of the FCC. So, and we've noted that. We noted that throughout this proceeding, that the standards were subject to change. And that was one of the reasons in the evidence and in the arguments at hearing that we focused so much on the Joint Board proceeding and the recommendations of the Joint Board. We now have some changed requirements and standards. We ask ourselves, why did the FCC commence this process of reviewing its ETC designation rules? The process was started because the FCC, for quite some time, has recognized and accepted the fact that the ETC designation process, as thus far implemented throughout the country, has not been consistent with the intent of Congress in their ETC designations provisions that are contained in the 1996 Act. The FCC has recognized and accepted that the current process is broken and it needed to be fixed. And that's the purpose of the new rules. The purpose of the new rules is to establish a more stringent test, more rigorous requirements than those that have been followed thus far. And we would disagree with some of the characterizations in RCC's brief indicating that really nothing has changed. Certainly the Highland and Virginia Cellular decisions strengthened the process and strengthened the requirements, but these rules even go further, and they particularly go further in the area of improvement plans or construction plans, and specifically what ETCs are required to file to show their commitment and ability to offer the services throughout the area. They shed some further light on what the cream skimming analysis should consist of, and there's other requirements as well that certainly are different and are stronger than even the standards that Highland and Virginia Cellular put in place. Now, we've set forth in our supplement brief a number of arguments as to why this commission should apply the newly established requirements and standards. This commission, I think generally in the prior ETC designations cases, has followed the FCC requirements and standards that were in effect at those times. And I've commented on that in our brief as to how this commission's analysis was similar to the FCC, similar in application in terms of applying FCC standards and requirements. The intended effect of the FCC's new requirements is to establish a more rigorous ETC designation process. According to the FCC, one which ensures that only fully qualified carriers that are capable of and committed to providing universal service will be able to receive support, and standards which improve the long-term sustainability of the Universal Service Fund. The FCC, in its order, report and order, also emphasized the need to establish a more predictable ETC designation process. We urge this commission to take action consistent with the stated goals of the FCC in adopting and utilizing standards that are more consistent with the universal service requirements in the federal act. In states like South Dakota, where rural telephone companies serving as carriers of last resort have a greater reliance on universal service support than carriers in many other states, protecting the long-term sustainability of the Federal Universal Service Fund should be the highest concern. We urge this commission to not shy away from the more rigorous designation requirements that the FCC has recently adopted, certainly which in part have been adopted as a means of addressing concerns over the sustainability of the fund. RCC has stated, gone so far to state that the current record is sufficient to meet the new requirements and standards. We disagree with that strongly. The record is probably more deficient with respect to the construction or improvement plans than in any other area. The FCC rule, as I noted earlier, really goes a lot further than previous standards or requirements in defining what sort of a construction or improvement plan should be insisted upon in the ETC designation process. And we would ask the commission to look closely at what's required under that rule. And whether the commission decides to apply the rules or not, I think what the substance of the rules tell you is that the issue of a carrier having the capability or showing the commitment and the capability to offer services throughout the area is a very important element of this entire process. And I think the rules give emphasis to the need for specific information in that area. And if you look at the record in this matter, there's nothing more than an identification of towers being built in four communities covering two of the 10 rural study areas in the first 18 months. That's something that falls very, very short of the FCC requirements. And to approve the ETC designation without further evidence on capability and commitment, I think, I don't believe that it sends a very good signal with respect to future designations, and it certainly isn't consistent with the public interest if you're concerned in undertaking the analysis and making a decision in the case is to make sure that consumers will actually benefit from the USF money that's distributed. I would like to, I guess, address just briefly this question of rulemaking. And it's been proposed that, you know, the commission should apply these standards to all carriers in the future by establishing them in rules. The commission to this point has really not seen the need to come up with specific rules defining what it should consider in its public interest analysis. It certainly looked at, you know, the FCC rules and looked at the FCC decisions. If you look at the current rules that we have on ETC designations, they don't go so far as to define what the specific criteria are for public interest review or really what the specific requirements are outside of referring to the FCC rules. I don't believe that it's essential for this commission to apply these new requirements through a rulemaking. That's not the way they proceeded with ETC designations in the past, and it's certainly within their discretion to continue to review the public interest in a more general way as cases come up on a case-by-case basis, looking to the standards that have been established by the FCC. Finally, with respect to the administrative rule, this 2010-3242, you know, I think at minimum what that rule emphasizes is that the definition defining the applicable service area is relevant to the public interest analysis. And I think that's consistent with the FCC rule, where the FCC has basically now said that, you know, if a carrier is asked for a redefinition, that the public interest should be taken into account within that request for redefinition. That's all I have, unless there are any questions.
If the FCC isn't applying it to pending designations, why should we?
Well, I think that we are a high-cost state, higher cost than most other states. And as I tried to, I guess, make the point in my remarks, issues over sustainability of the fund, I think, should be deemed more important in our state than maybe in other states. And I would like to see this commission give, you know, those sorts of goals the appropriate recognition. And I think by applying these new standards, which are more consistent with what is intended under the Federal Act and more consistent with sustaining the fund, it all boils down to what's in the public interest. If we're here to review the public interest, in our view, you know, you need to make sure that you've got an appropriate balance between competition and spurring competition and promoting competition and maintaining universal service. That's the purpose of these new requirements. I think if the commission is interested in doing that, they should apply the new requirements, and I think it's within their discretion to do so.
And should the commission, like the FCC, apply these requirements to all ETCs, including those previously designated, such as your companies?
Yeah, I think the requirements apply across the board. Now, with respect to what's required in a specific, with respect to filings, I think that common sense should also come into play. If you've got companies that have been providing service for 50 years and they have a network that is built out throughout their service area, I think that the information that you need to satisfy yourself that the companies are truly offering their service throughout the area, I would think that you would have some discretion in that area. I think that with respect to rural companies that are landline, there's some reference to, line extension policies, deposit policies, and so forth, where a company has a ubiquitous network. And you're talking about, well, is that company, you're asking questions as to whether that company is offering its services in response to reasonable requests for service. Those are the sorts of things that are probably more important with landline than actually ubiquitous network deployment, which you know is there.
That's all I had.
Thanks.
Any questions from any commissioners at this point?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to note that I am back in the hearing room. I asked a court reporter to note on the record when I entered so that I'd be able to see what point I need to read the transcript up to. But since we have an audio record, I did want to note for the audio record that I'm back. And this is Commissioner Saar. Thanks.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you. I'm John Smith, for attorney for commission staff. I basically agree, I guess, with Mr. LaFuria. In RCC that the new FCC decision, I don't believe, affects a change in law. The decision was clear in the fact that it is not meant to be a dictate down to state commissions. There were some strong, encouraging words in there, but it very clearly and very explicitly was not made binding upon state commissions. Therefore, I do not think it can be said to be a change in law. And secondly, even if it were, it's not effective as of this date. That said, even if it were to be perceived to be a change in law, I did a quick look, and even with respect to such provisions, the U.S. Supreme Court has stated in the old Iowa Public Service case that in cases where a change in law would affect a serious injustice, that the provisions be provided only to cases that are not pending at the time the law is enacted, absent an explicit directive from the legislature to do otherwise. And so I guess it's my feeling here that realistically that I think it's unfair to RCC to apply standards of which it could not be aware at the time to this case. And that other than that, I agree with Mr. Coit to the extent that there are certain sort of tenor guidance that you can get out of the decision in terms of maybe how to view the standards that existed prior to the decision and what emphasis maybe to give on some of those provisions. And I think those are irrespective of the more rote particularized requirements that are in the new decision, such as a 5-year plan and some of those things that this commission may or may not decide to adopt in the future. It's possible you may disagree with the SEC that some of those things are useful. And I think it's at least arguable whether the sort of, and I think we've gone over this in the past in the Western Wireless case, as to whether we want sort of a Soviet-style 5-year plan regime. You know, does that really work in the real world? Or do we just want a monitoring process that does hold the company's feet to the fire and makes them in the way businesses really do things, which is begin a capital planning process, something along the lines of about a 12 to 18-month lead time, and with about a 12 to 18-month lead time, which has always remained subject to contingencies and changes. I mean, that's really the way things work in the real time. On that particular issue, I think the real issue in the case is the one that I think both the interveners and the staff attempted to hammer home during the proceedings, the hearings. And that really is taking a close look at whether you really believe the evidence shows that RCC has that level of commitment. I think, again, this is a little company by comparison with Western Wireless, and I think their perspective on what they're able to do and the confidence with which they're able to assert that they're able to do it is a little more circumspect than it was with Western Wireless, largely, one might say, because I think they probably are constrained in terms of the resources they have to bring to bear to any particular building agenda. But that said, if I were to encourage the commission to emphasize one particular area, it would be that, and whether you believe the RCC showed the requisite level of commitment to really get out there and build throughout the service area. With respect to Mr. Coit's point about preserving the Universal Service Fund, again, I really think that puts the commission in, and again, this is the FCC's problem, really. I'm not blaming SDTA for this or interveners. But I think it puts the commission really in just a ridiculously terrible position to begin to be making decisions on that basis. And I don't see really why the FCC can't get it that it's doing that to us in these cases. In the sense that I'll give you an example here. For one thing, there's no evidence in the record that I could see that any increase in universal service funds or any additional pressure would result on the universal service fund as a result of RCC's grant of a designation. I think it's as likely, and one of the areas of questioning, if you recall, that I pursued during the hearing was whether the issue isn't really almost the exact opposite, that it's possible you're going to have less impact on the Universal Service Fund with two designees. And the reason for that is it's at least possible that by designating more than one carrier in an area, you're going to actually slow the rate of deployment. And unless you assume that two carriers will have a significantly greater impact on marketing in the area and the total number of customers electing to go with a mode, you're actually going to result in less total lines served, and you may, in fact, save the Universal Service Fund money. And I only throw that out just to point out the idea that it might sound like nice verbiage, but in terms of any actual record evidence that we have in this case or any other case that these designations are going to cost the Universal Service Fund money, I just don't think we have it. And so I just don't see that as a viable means of making a decision in this case. The one area you may take a look at, and whether you want to or not, is the wire center as being the minimal area for service area definition. I don't think that really was an extension of what the FCC did in Virginia and Highland, so I don't think it's unfair to apply that particular criteria in this case. What the FCC did here, I think, was just reiterate that and reiterate it more strongly and more unambiguously than it had in those two cases. And I think they asserted it more as a universal principle. Again, as Mr. LaFuria pointed out, the FCC in the pending redefinition cases before it elected not to rigidly apply that wire center as a minimum service area. But it's something you might at least want to think about. I don't know that it matters that much in this case. And pardon my throat, by the way. I'm under the influence of allergy pills and have a very dry mouth. The only thing that did concern me, again, in the case of concerning the wire center as the minimum boundary, and why it may be that you would want to do that. Again, and this whole method of doing this to me is, again, a very bizarre way of handling things. But it appears as though the FCC is clearly stating that the actual redefinition occurs at the local rural LEC level, that it doesn't just occur with respect to the new applicant. So it won't affect just a redefinition for RCC. It's going to affect a redefinition right down to the, with respect to the actual rural LECs. I think if you take a look at that map that was handed out this morning, you'll see that you're going to then end up with some service areas in the state, if you were to go that way, that are literally a mile wide and a couple miles long. And you're going to have the LECs, rural LECs, have to make their filings on the basis of a multitude of these teeny tiny little service areas. And that, to me, that is going to mean some additional burden to them. But that's something just to keep in mind. And lastly, I guess the only other comment I would have is that you might want to add one condition in this case that could be fairly general, that would just make it clear that if you elect not to apply the new decision standards in this case, sort of like a savings condition, that would state that they will be applied at least to the extent they are ultimately adopted by this commission at some point in the future, and that at such time those provisions will become applicable to RCC in this case. Thank you.
Roland, do you have some questions?
Sure.
Oh, sure.
Uh-huh. Don, do you still have any concerns about joint designation? You brought it up in your first
report. I have a technical concern. I really do, and I guess it's one of those frustrating things. In our data request to the companies, I guess we threw out the suggestion as strongly as we could throw it out that they amend their petition to make application at the next corporate level up, at one parental level up, so we wouldn't have this problem. Again, it's probably more of a technical issue, but the fact is Wireless Alliance isn't authorized to provide service in the northeast corner of the state, and so they can't possibly technically provide service throughout that area. Again, it's a technical nit, I guess, but...
And then you were talking about, at the very end, about redefining down to very little service areas, but Isn't there, even under option one, they're only asking to redefine down to the wire setting, right?
Well, if you look at the original application, their request was that they be defined along their licensed boundary line areas.
Okay, they'd be designated as an ETC in the licensed areas, but that the redefinition still would be at the wire center level.
I didn't understand it that way.
Okay.
I understood them to be asking for redefinition of the service area along their licensed boundary areas. If I misunderstood that, I'm sorry.
And then with rural Beresford, do you have – I guess I didn't understand staff's concern about cream skimming. It seems like that was one of the most densely wire exchanges. And so why would –
Again, I can't remember okay. the exact data. It's one that Mr. Best and I looked explicitly at that. I guess you might take a look at whether Beresford, as it might have shown up in some of the numbers, included Beresford Town, which, as you recall, they originally believed it did. Given the rural Beresford service area, as it looks to me on the map, it would be very surprising to me if that were one of the most densely populated in that area. But maybe you're right.
I don't. And
I can't remember because it's been a couple months since I looked at that.
And then I know this has been brought up too much, but do you think I know that in their original petition that they also asked for it to be granted certification? Do you think the commission can grant certification in this proceeding, or should it be done separately? In our certification proceedings where they have to show how much money they think they will get and then how much money they intend to spend throughout the area. Well, do you think the commission can certify in this proceeding?
I don't know. I haven't looked into that. They certainly could not, I don't think, with respect to those portions for which you would have to grant a designation conditionally because you haven't
completed. Oh, for the redefined. Okay. And then I was just double-checking your conditions against the Western Wireless ones. And I know you left some of them out. I'm just wondering if there was a particular reason, and maybe just because you don't think they need that, but like list of local calling areas, ensuring that agreements are consistent with service quality rules. Did you just think it didn't apply in these cases?
I honestly don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember that.
That's all I had. Thanks.
Any questions for commission members?
I do have a few, and I was wondering if I could get a copy of the ETC map that was handed out earlier. Please. Thank you.
He has one. That's right.
Mr. Smith, when we look at the two areas that are where ETC designation is being requested. Do you see anything that we should do to distinguish the differences between the what I'll term the northeast part of the state and the greater Sioux Falls market?
I didn't really see that. I think the challenge of this whole thing will be much as I think we think it will be with Western Wireless, and that is, I really think if you choose to designate both areas, I think the real challenge is to make sure that all the money doesn't get spent in the Sioux Falls area. And in the, and I think that's going to be a challenge, is to force any of these companies to get out there and build in the areas where they're not going to make money. They're going to lose money. I mean, that's a fact, and they're not going to want to do it. I mean, in this case, we know that because the testimony of Mr. Gruss was clear that they're going to base their decisions on tower construction on a particular facility addition return on investment analysis. That's what he said at the hearing. And so I think assuming you go forward with designation, I mean, I think the tough thing is to get it through their heads that, no, you're not going to do that.
And do you think there's any reason to distinguish between or among different forms of wireless technology? I mean, as we're trying to grapple with some of these that are clearly policy issues, is there some advantage to looking at and saying, well, there are some public interest in perhaps a technology that, that on its face serves a wider radius and potentially more people, or do you think that there is a some holes in that sort of logic of looking at it technology by technology?
Probably not, although I honestly think the real issue is commitment to build out. You're right, I think the testimony in the record was that the PCS facilities at this point in time at least have a less wide reach, and that may be, they have different characteristics, period, you know, but I didn't see anything in this record from which I don't think staff would be able to make a recommendation on the basis of a particular mode. There were some issues as between the two service areas that I think Mr. Coyton brought up to some extent in his brief, and I think those might relate more to the question Ms. Wiest asked first in terms of should there be a joint designation, and that may have some bearing on that. I mean, these the two companies don't even use the same technology. They don't use the same network. The testimony with respect to the one was that their network is based in Alexandria, and with respect to Wireless Alliance, it uses a completely different set of network facilities. As I recall, that was in Eagan, Minnesota, or somewhere in the Twin Cities area.
Are there any things in particular with using two different forms of technology that you would think the commission should pay close attention to if RCC does, in fact, get granted ETC designation in both areas? As far as I think generally, it's, at least from our experience with Western Wireless, it was something that I think was fairly generic, mm-hmm. and probably could apply regardless of whether you're talking about PCS or cellular. Mm-hmm. Anything off the top of your head that you see that makes this any different?
Not really. As I recall, they were talking about deploying CDMA throughout their northern region, which isn't just South Dakota, and taking that then to the next level in terms of the new generation of capabilities in their cellular area. And I think the thing with PCS, of course, is, you know, it's going to, if it has less reach, there may be additional pressure to be brought to bear to build more tower facilities. That may be the most difficult thing. Again, I think being too technologically specific is, I don't know that that's authorized by the rules. As Mr. LaFuria pointed out, the commission is required to be competitively neutral. And as I recall, the rules about competitive neutrality, those involve neutrality as among differing technologies.
And I think that's a fair statement. Looking at the, regardless of technology, looking at the two different areas, do you think there's any sort of public policy considerations that we should apply when you have on its face the northeast corner of the state where there's a number of small towns that aren't served?
Right.
And frankly, based on, you know, what we know about build-out plans and so on and so forth in rural parts of the state, might be the sort of towns where you might not expect to get service within the next 1 to 2 to 3 years, as compared to perhaps the greater Sioux Falls market where you may already have other providers available, and certainly if not, you know, there is some likelihood that there may be 4 or 5 players within these greater Sioux Falls markets that, if they're not there, could be reasonably expected to make an effort to go out and build in those, I'll call them suburbs or communities right outside of Sioux Falls.
Yes, I think you can consider that. In fact, that's one of the points Mr. Coit made, I think, fairly well in his brief, that in some of the areas here you have several overlays already. You have some of those areas in both of these service areas. Along the I-29 corridor, whether you go south of Sioux Falls or up north, you have several different providers already providing service. And my guess, without knowing totally, is that if you get down into the more isolated areas of either of these areas, you're probably not going to have that. You're right, though. I mean, obviously, in that Sioux Falls, greater Sioux Falls area, it's probable to me that you're going to have deployment of multiple carriers by multiple carriers much sooner. And I think you can consider that.
And then it's certainly not an unexpected question. I mean, one of the things that comes up, whether at the commission level or regional meetings or national meetings, when you talk about wireless ETC, certainly is it something where we should be concerned about funding multiple ETCs, or do you let the market take care of it itself? I mean, it's per line basis, not per tower, so on and so forth. I mean, is there a point in time where a commission should be concerned about granting 2, 3, 4 wireless ETCs in an area from a policy standpoint, or do you think that the, so to speak, the per line funding takes care of itself?
It's one of the frustrating things for me about the FCC's decisions of late, and this one is just another one in that line. And they seem incapable of comprehending the real nature of the decision that a commission's called upon to make in a very high-cost area. And that isn't effects on the Universal Service Fund. It's effects on universal service within that particular service area. I think if you remember the line of questioning that I embarked on during the hearing and mainly concentrated on, it was really just that. It's, might you not, and if you remember, a lot of those questions were directed at Randy Hodek, who's out there running a very high-cost facility right now, and how it might affect his ability within his particular service area to provide universal service, particularly out in the real sticks. If he were denied, or if his lower cost revenues were parceled up into 2, 3, 4 chunks, so that instead of him getting the money from Oneida and from Highmore, and it's really amazing when we call that the low cost areas, but the Sisseton's of the world and those towns, if those funds are unavailable to you, where you can actually make a buck to spend in Lebanon, or out on a farm that's 15 miles outside of town. I mean, to me, that is a real concern, that if you begin to carve up that lower cost pie enough, it would just seem to me that you're going to have less revenue available for any carrier that's out there to be able to go out into that very high cost area. Now, that said, the FCC, and again, this is not binding on this commission, but in this particular decision, the FCC, after going through all this nice rhetoric about per line support amounts and all that, then it explicitly found that you should not limit to one wireless and one wireline carrier, or any particular number. Instead, they went off again on this thing of worrying about the effect on the Universal Service Fund, which is something that any particular state is going to have an extremely tough time doing, because we don't know what they're doing in Michigan, And so for us to say that in this particular case that RCC, by designating RCC, we're somehow having an effect on the Universal Service Fund when it's on a per handset basis, I just think that's an extremely difficult finding to make on the record we have. That's not to say this commission couldn't go a different direction than the FCC. I think you have to do it, though, on the grounds not of protecting the Universal Service Fund and all that, but you'd have to do it based on the finding that it actually will undermine the ability of universal service to be provided within these particular proposed service areas. And I don't think it's beyond the realm of credibility that's possible.
And focusing on the effect, and certainly I think you did a good job, as you mentioned, at hearing, fleshing out some of the effects on landline ETCs, but just on the side of wireless ETCs, mm-hmm. is there some policy argument, and of course we have to apply this within the context of federal law and federal commission orders, Is there a policy argument that perhaps one can even fire, one can even have too many wireless ETCs in the more rural areas of the state, meaning you essentially could make it so that if you have multiple people coming in and serving a very small community, you know, let's say it's a 200-person community, and you have two ETCs there, the customer base may be something that would be difficult for two companies, two providers to sustain good service in that particular region. I mean, is there any concern that you can see even among just the multiple wireless ETCs with having multiple designations in areas, or are we in a situation where, you know, the best policy is to, you know, take the money and run and see what happens with the market, or should we be concerned about the possibility of getting too many wireless players into a particular area?
Well, I think it's a definite concern. Again, I don't know that we totally know that yet, because I don't know that we've gotten there yet with respect to any carrier in terms of compelling the build-out into the very high-cost and very unattractive areas. The evidence in this case, just take a look at your map again. If you take a look at the map and the evidence we went over and over about that, where towers get built is where the people are. But I think the challenge in terms of if we really mean what we say in terms of universal service and holding companies to universal service principles, and I think universal service, it means universal. And the statute says, what does that mean? It means service throughout the designated service area. It doesn't mean in places where I have enough enough revenue from that particular tower deployment necessarily to earn a profit on that particular facility. Now, so what that means, and there was a number of places in the record where this was addressed, but it really gets down to averaging. It gets down to cost averaging, and that's what it boils down to, is looking at the entire service area as a lump, as opposed to viewing any particular point of development as a profit center in and of itself. I think that's going to be the challenge, and I think the answer is it's possible. If you designate and you carve up the revenue pie, again, unless the assumption, we don't really have evidence on the record as to this, and so I don't think you can base a finding on this. Common sense tells me that when you add multiple carriers, you may have some very small increment of increase in the total number of persons within that area willing to buy a cell phone. But the increase in the total cell phone customer universe is probably not going to be that huge. So in turn, what that means is you're going to be taking the revenue pie that's available for that particular area, and you're going to be dividing it up amongst several companies. And does that make it more or less likely that you will have deployment into the very, very high-cost areas? I think one could deduce from even the record in this case that it's going to make it less likely. In staff's brief, what we concluded is that it's possible even to conclude that from the record, although the evidence wasn't that strong. We concluded that there was an insufficient regulatory framework, either in federal law, state law, or FCC guidance, from which to go down that path. And actually, this new decision makes it less, it lends less support to going down that path rather than more support.
And let's take one hypothetical as far as application of what a order may look like coming from this commission with RCC. Mm-hmm. You know, let's take a scenario where, so we'll say company A and company B. Company A comes in and says, here's our build-out plan. We intend to serve Esteline. Company B comes in and says, here's our build-out plan. We intend to serve Esteline. And let's say neither one are going to go out and serve Veblen. Now, I think one of the last places this commission wants to be in there is second-guessing private businesses and their decisions. At the same time, is there any considerations given to, especially if universal service money is being used to fund these communities, to having any sort of oversight or review or some sort of role in the process to make sure that we are, in fact, getting out there and serving as many underserved communities as possible?
I think the answer there is yes. Again, right now I can only speak with respect to Western Wireless, who is the only wireless ETC in the state. And the answer is in really, it's in a very embryonic phase. But we just went through our first report from Western Wireless that involves the submission of build-out plans. And that was a concern. And the concern right now, of course, isn't electing between two carriers where you're going to put your stuff. It really was more taking a look at what they were proposing and then comparing it against where the commission staff may be perceiving, having its maybe differing opinion in some cases of demand, sometimes through our own internal network of complaints, et cetera, and the reporting systems that we've developed, which I can tell you honestly are there again in a very we're in the beginnings of doing this. So that mechanism of getting our input, commission's input in the form of the staff, down into a little deeper and into the planning process, it isn't there yet. But that is the path that's going down, and yeah, I would see that as being possible. That once we're looking at two carriers with ETC in the same area, I would certainly think we might be looking at trying to get the two carriers to maybe be coordinated so we'd get coverage sooner. And again, remember some of the questions and evidence from the commission during the proceeding dealt with the wisdom of things like co-location and some other things where we could get costs down on deployment if we're going to have to designate multiple ETCs and not build a separate tower for every company.
And then the final obvious question is, you know, if we do put limitations on the number of ETCs, I mean, do we create some sort of race to the commission? Is it dangerous policy to look out there and saying, okay, there's going to be one, there's going to be two, there's going to be three, pick the number, and does it create kind of some odd results possibly with whoever gets here first is the winner and whoever doesn't is the loser?
I think there is. And one of the precise rationales given by the FCC for rejecting an arbitrary limitation of number of ETCs was just that. I think going down that path, that's a significant policy departure from what previous FCC decisions have held. In effect, as I think we pointed out in our original brief, that the philosophy when you go down that path is very similar to any other franchising type philosophy. And it's pretty much the philosophy that we have had with respect to rural X historically. I mean, that's really what we have had historically here is basically a franchise system. It's what we have today in the electric system here in South Dakota. But I think the bottom line is that's really what you'd be talking about. It's in effect, and how did those Rolex franchises or the cable franchise in Sioux Falls, Midco, how did they get in that situation? I mean, the truth is, originally at least, same thing. They were the first there. The problem I think we have here is I think the legal framework for that here in this case is very weak to start saying we're only going to approve one and make that a cut-and-dried road decision. That's even weaker in the wake of the last decision.
Nevertheless, Mr. LaFleur, I will give Rich an opportunity just to address some of the remarks that
Do you wish to positively be last? Or?
Sure.
All right.
I'd be happy to have you go first.
All right. Mr. Coit, would you like... All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. I'll try to be brief, even though I now have more than I had when I got started. Let me start with perhaps staff's most important point, and I apologize if I jump around a little bit, and please feel free to jump in with questions. I think staff's most important point was, you know, and we agree with it. What is the effect on the universal service? What is the effect on universal service? Not necessarily what is the effect on the universal service fund. And what I want the commission to understand is that while certainly all of us, no matter where we stand on this, would have liked to have seen a little more detail or a little better guidance from the FCC, if you look back all the way to 1997 when their first report and order came out, there is a stack of paper that is probably 4 feet high now in terms of what they have provided on how this system is supposed to work and how they want it to work, and they've been very consistent in implementing a plan for making universal service work coexistent with advancing competition as required by the Congress in 96. So I want to address how they did that because I think it will bring together a lot of answers to a lot of the things that were raised in the recent Q&A. I think the biggest concern is what happens when an ILEC has a high-cost area and a low-cost area, and a competitor comes in and takes away the low-cost customers. If I understand it, that's a significant concern that this commission has. What do we do if an ILEC is left with only the high-cost portions? How are they going to meet the revenue requirements? I believe the FCC's system sufficiently addresses that, and it does so in the following way. Bear with me as I try to pull this together immediately. The FCC currently has rules in place which say that the ILEC does not lose support for its network when a new competitor comes in. That is, when RCC or Western or any other ETC comes into the marketplace, they will get support only when they get a customer, and they get only the per-line support that the ILEC gets for that customer. Now, it can be presumed, based on a return rate of return analysis, that the competitors are going to enter the lower-cost portions first. And indeed, I think if you look at this map, you could say without support, that's without my even knowing much about South Dakota. I know Sioux Falls is the lower-cost area, and I would make a bet that in the places where RCC has located these cell sites, and I think you'll find it in the record, that generally they are the lower cost portions of that area. It makes perfect sense. Without support, that's the only place you're going to construct. My thesis is this. In places like Sioux Falls and in these communities, which are generally lower cost, competition is going to come here whether you designate these companies as ETCs or not. They're going to eat away at the ILECs. Dominance, their monopoly market share in these areas, irrespective of whether you designate them as ETCs. If they never get a dime, they're going to continue to improve their service in these little areas until they can compete. So what is the answer with universal service support? The answer is competitors in Sioux Falls and in these communities should not be receiving significant amounts, if any, of high-cost support. They should not be rewarded for doing so. You can make a fairly good argument that in Sioux Falls, you may get 4 or 5 new competitors into that market. I argue, great, but they shouldn't all get a high amount of high-cost support for doing so because they're going to come here without support anyway. The answer that the FCC drew up in 2001, and an answer which the ILEC signed on to, was disaggregation of support. It was done after 2 years of Rural Task Force hearings and 6 white papers, and you can look it all up where they all came to the decision, and as I say, it's one of the few things that wireless and ILECs agreed upon. There shouldn't be rewards for competing here. Let's move the support out to these white spaces, assuming that this map is correct and that these white spaces represent the higher cost areas. Let's get the big dollars out there. Your question is, how do you provide an incentive for a competitor to get out there? Do you get involved in private business decisions and say, we want you to build in this particular community because it doesn't have service? My answer is no. My answer is, if that community is truly remote, instead of getting $2 or $1 of support, as should probably be the case in the low-cost areas, have these companies disaggregate. And when they put 20, 30, and I know in this state there's places where there's $80 of per-line support available per month, per line, you'll provide a pretty powerful incentive for every new ETC, every wireless carrier, to do a rate of return investment analysis. How many customers are there? How much support dollars are available there? How many customer dollars of revenue are available there? And how many other competitors are in the market now? Do I have the ability to build facilities in this area? And if you add all those numbers up and the answer is yes, you'll get at least one in there. Which brings me to the question of, what do you do about the possibility that there's four or five ETCs designated out in this high-cost area? Again, the per-line support methodology that the FCC has put together solves this problem for you. You need not make market-based determinations the carriers make. And the reason is, let's use that community of 200, for example, and let's assume that it takes one cell site for the purposes of this example, one cell site to serve that community and backhaul facilities, and it adds up to $300,000. The first new ETC that goes in there is going to do that rate of return analysis and make that determination. Can I build a facility in here and make a return? If the answer is no, they're not going to build. And they're still going to have their ETC obligations. So the only way they can fulfill their ETC obligations is to resell on the existing carrier's network. That may be all that's available there. And it's possible that that's all that's available. However, if it does make sense and they build a cell site there, you now have one wireless carrier in that market. If you designate a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth, I don't really care how many you designate. You designate 20. Going too fast? Sure.
If you designate
a third, a fourth, I really don't care how many ETCs you designate in this area. Each subsequent ETC would have an obligation to serve customers who request in that area. But each subsequent ETC also has the common sense and obvious business requirement to determine whether they can afford to build a cell site there, knowing that there's a competitor that's already got customers, knowing that they have to share support, knowing that they have no guaranteed return, and knowing that ultimately it has to make business sense to do so. So they may decide, number two, number three, they may decide that they can't build there, but what they have to do is resell. And so now the benefit you have for consumers is, A, they've got wireless service in the area, requesting consumers can get it, and they also have a second ETC that they can look to who may provide different service options, different local calling areas. They may knit them together with other places in the state where they provide service and offer features. There are a whole raft of benefits that the consumers would see in this area from having more than one competitive ETC, even if they only have one network on which to make their calls. And as a reseller in that area, the second, the third, and the fourth ETC, they don't get support for doing it. So if they have a customer by resell, they get zero. It's only the carrier with facilities that gets ETC support. And so coming back to, I think it was Mr. Hudak's concerns, his concerns are very real. His lunch is going to get eaten first in his lowest cost areas, whether that's a really truly low cost area or whether it's in most rural communities, it's the lower cost portions. It's still a fairly high cost area oftentimes in these rural areas. But competitors are going to go there first, and he's got that problem irrespective of whether there are ETCs or not. The per-line support methodology and disaggregation forces carriers to go out to the higher cost areas if they want to get any level of support. So in conclusion, you may get some areas that don't get construction. That's always possible. But what you get is every incentive for it to be done out there by having carriers move their dollars out. The state of Washington conducted a proceeding several years ago where they forced every ILEC to disaggregate their support. They moved all their money out to the highest cost portions of the area so that as a competitive ETC in Washington, if you want to build in the Seattle Metro or Tacoma or all these areas, you get nothing. You get very few dollars sometimes. Sometimes it's pennies per month. But if you go out to eastern Washington, where it's just as rural as it is here in South Dakota, it's less than one person per square mile in some cases, there's real dollars out there. There's up to $100 a month out there for carriers that are willing to take the chance and go out there and build facilities. If you give me just a moment to go through my notes, I'll try to minimize what I have left. I did want to answer, I think it was Commissioner Saar, your question about the technology and the difference in technologies. I can tell you that the technology is transparent to the consumer in terms of whether they can receive the 9 supported services. They're going to get it, whether it's analog, CDMA, GSM, or otherwise. It matters not how those services are provided to the consumer. It will be transparent to them, and the obligation to provide the 9 supported services stays the same no matter which technology the company chooses. I'm not sure if that answers your concern, but... I wanted to speak just a moment to Mr. Coit's comments about RCC somehow downplaying the process. I mean, I hardly think that RCC has downplayed the process in this case. The company's been pending for 17 months, and it has submitted a substantial record. I think there's a terrific record in this proceeding on which the commission can make all of the findings, including the capability and commitment, which I'll step to in just a second. I think if you compare the record here with the record in the Western case previously, I think you'll find there's plenty of record evidence to designate. I think if you compare it to the Virginia Cellular and the Highland Cellular records at the FCC, and honestly, I represented both of those companies, there is no question but that this record is far more substantial than what they submitted there. And for the interveners to suggest that the FCC has found that the process is broken, I think is emphatically is so wrong, only because the FCC has never conducted a proceeding that is nearly as detailed or as adversarial or as significant as what we have here. They've never conducted a full hearing. They've never conducted briefings. They've never had oral argument. They've never pulled together the extensive evidence on any issue, including cream skimming, that you have in front of you here in this proceeding. So far from the FCC feeling that the process is broken, I think they feel that what they want is more consistent standards in the future. But there was nothing in that order that indicated, and I've heard nothing from the FCC to indicate that states are not doing this properly. And in the very few states that have designated very aggressively, the commission has not pointed them out or in any way made statements to indicate that they're not doing it properly. The state of Washington has never conducted a hearing either, and I've not heard the – and they've designated as many as 10 or 11 ETCs now, and I don't think the FCC has ever – said anything that indicates that they're not doing this properly or not affording due process or anything else. I think that interveners in their comments here talked a lot about there being a more rigorous process. And my response to that is, it seems to me that what they really want is to selectively apply portions of the FCC's rules. They want you to take, for example, 209 of the new proposed rules that will become effective in May, let's say, and they want you to, say, apply those here right now in this proceeding. But while you're at it, please ignore B, which says the FCC is not going to apply that in their existing proceedings. And I think their selectiveness here is really I think that's really the turning point of your decision. I mean, I think you can look at that and say, you know, clearly this is the way that it should go procedurally. There's good law that says that a change of law does not result in additional proceedings, and the FCC is doing it this way. So if we're going to follow their game plan, we should follow all of it and just not parts of it selectively. As far as RCC's capability and commitment, you know, the company was very specific. It told you a projection of how many dollars they thought they were going to get in the first year, year and a half. They told you how they're going to spend those dollars, where they're going to spend those dollars, and they made provisions so that you understood that all of those dollars are being spent out in the higher cost areas to extend their network beyond where it is now. I think you have the potential to do a very good job of calling all ETCs back every year and asking a few very simple questions. How much money did you get last year compared to what you projected? What did you do with it to improve service out in these rural areas? How many dollars do you expect to get in the next year? And where do you expect to spend those dollars? Come back next year and tell us what you did. And every single year, you can look at this map and you can say, are we doing any better in terms of filling this in? After 15 years of being licensed, there's been a licensee holding this area for now 15 years. RCC hasn't been the license holder for that whole time. This is what's been built. And I would suggest to you, if there was a real business plan to build all these other areas, it would have happened. And without support, you're not going to see substantial additional construction in these areas in the foreseeable future. I mean, that's what this proceeding is all about, new cell sites in these areas to improve service for rural consumers. In terms of sustainability of the fund, I mean, we couldn't agree more with staff. I think our calculations are that $1.5 million on a $3.9 billion fund represents 1/2000th of the fund. It's minuscule. And when it comes to sustainability of the fund, we urge you not to look to the ILEX for concern about growth in the fund. I mean, this is a group that filed suit against the FCC in federal court to overturn caps when the FCC proposed to cap their funding. Their concern for support in the fund, for growth in the fund, has really been sharpened when competitors have had a chance to enter in a competitive way and take a bite out of their customer base. As far as continuing reporting requirements, I think, you know, there's no question but that we need a rulemaking here. If I understood anything from Mr. Coit's comments, you know, you have a company that maybe has been operating for 50-plus years. You know, in 2005, there are different questions you have to ask to each carrier, and they can't be resolved in this proceeding in order to be competitively neutral. ILEX and the state now get approximately $52 million a year in support, and I think the total amount going to competitors, wireless and wireline, this year will amount to about $16 million. And so I think your question to the ILEX, since they've pretty much they have mature networks that, as a general matter, are not growing rapidly, the question is, you're getting $52 million and you've built out the whole state. What are you doing with these funds? And I don't think anybody really understands exactly where these funds go. There's not an auditing procedure in place at the FCC that examines closely high numbers of rural ILEC expenditures throughout the country. We just don't have that right now. And to the extent that you want to start to look at that, it's a subject which is far bigger than this proceeding and obviously would need to be done in a rulemaking. And it may be that here in the state you have certain controls and certain things in place where you're satisfied that the ILECs have done everything they need to do, and that's just fine. But to consider it at all can't be done in this proceeding. To be competitively neutral, getting comments from parties throughout the state and looking at it in a rulemaking really is the way to go. Finally, one quick comment on staff. There was one comment from staff that the ILEX would need to make their filings on a wire center basis if you redefine them down to the wire center level, and there would be some administrative burden as a result. My understanding is that that would not happen. That is that the redefining of a service area does not change for the ILEX in any way how they report their costs to this commission. The only time that would change would be if the ILEX disaggregate their support down to the wire center level. So for those who have, they're going to be doing that or they're already doing it. And were you to do like Washington did, for example, and cause all of the ILECs to disaggregate their support, then they would have an additional burden to report their costs on a wire center by wire center basis. So I don't think there would be any additional administrative burden. And finally, I think on the certification, I do believe there's enough evidence in the record in terms of the projected amount of support that RCC would receive in the first year, their commitment to construct and expand their system with the dollars that they project that they'll get in the first year, such that you could certify them for that one-year basis. And we would ask that you do so shortly after the designation so that funds could commence at the earliest possible date. And then a year out from now, you'll have an opportunity to review this again. And if the company has not, if the company said we got these funds and we spent them in Minnesota, for example, you wouldn't recertify them presumably for the next year. And that concludes my remarks. I'm happy to take any additional questions.
Thank you very much. My apologies to Sherry. I didn't know this was going to go as long as it is. Do you need to take any sort of break at this point? All right. I'll have a few questions. Do you folks have any questions?
Certainly not 45 minutes.
All right. All right. Well, it's not necessarily how long the questions are. It's how long the answers are.
I promise to do my best.
I have then a couple questions. Some of them are hopefully very obvious. And are the new standards beneficial, in your opinion, to the consumers if they are applied?
That's a good question. As a general matter, no. And I say that because I think there are a few that could be. But just to use the five-year plan, for example, the commission was very careful in our Virginia Cellular case to tell us, we understand when you propose all these new cell sites that you may build them in different places or you may spend your funds in a different way, and that's not a problem. Come back to us every year and tell us what you've done, and we're going to examine whether you're using support to benefit rural consumers and expand your network. But we're not going to hold you to what you propose here. Now they've come up with a five-year plan, and I think they're going to engender more confusion and more difficulty than they understand, in that, number one, they'll have to apply it competitively neutral basis to ILECs in some way, and I think that represents a whole separate set of problems. Number two, in terms of consumers, I don't know how consumers are going to get service any faster as a result of a five-year plan or a one-year plan. Given that there's an annual review, I don't know that there's any real use for this commission seeing plans so far down the road, which, as anybody knows, in a rapidly changing marketplace and where technologies change rapidly, plans are likely to change. Any five-year plan that any carrier with an immature network gives you at this stage is going to be largely a guess, and it's going to be more of a guess as you get past 12 months. 12 months, I think you get a pretty good fix on what they're going to do because they've budgeted for the next year and they've made those decisions. 2 years out, it gets to be more of a guess. By the time you get to 5 years, there's no way to know what the marketplace is going to be like, what the levels of support will be. I mean, those rules could change, and if support were cut in half, for example, then the amount of construction they could do would presumably go down. You have a very practical problem of communities. Perhaps it would be revealed publicly that these five communities are on the plan year three or year four. And when year three comes, if support were cut in half, suddenly they're not on the plan because there's no high-cost support to do it. I'd suggest those communities would be fairly disappointed, whether it would be disappointed with us or the commissioner or whoever else. I don't think the FCC ever took that into account when they said for a five-year plan. As far as local usage goes, I don't think the FCC understood fully that competitors already have a wide variety of local usage plans that provide plenty of benefits to consumers. The benefits to consumers don't come from a particular local usage plan. They come from having new network facilities so that they can make calls and we can have economic development. And so I think you've got, when you get a competitor in there, a competitor is going to do everything he possibly can to give consumers as much value as he can to take customers from other competitors. And so I don't know that there's a whole lot of value there. In terms of how do you handle your network, I think there is some value to consumers there, and I think it is worth this commission at some point having all carriers be able to report to this commission how do they deal with network outages and problems, and how are they designing procedures to take care of emergencies, for example. I think that's fair. I think it's reasonably related to the goals of universal service, which is to see the carriers are providing high-quality service. And I don't think it's particularly intrusive. It doesn't get into making decisions for where a carrier builds a cell site, for example. And I can't honestly remember the other. There were four things out there. But I think in general that covers it.
Well, you covered sustainability of USF earlier.
Yes.
Generally speaking, you don't think they're of a tremendous benefit, and possibly one or two of the rules may be of benefit.
I don't think they'll have huge benefits to consumers, and my concern is that the more regulation is placed on all carriers, the more dollars are spent to comply with regulations. And I know in the ILEC world, because they receive support differently than do competitors. In the ILEC world, the cost of regulation is a part of their rates, and it's necessarily then a part of their revenue requirement, and it's a part of the universal service support that they get. So as regulatory requirements rise, thus also, although I don't know it's that significant, there is a corresponding rise in the need for universal service support.
You heard John Smith testify that he did not think it was fair to apply the new regulations, which I assume you agree with. Is it your opinion that we have the right to apply them? You had said earlier that there is good law providing that we should not. So it's for
yes.
My question is, do you mean to intimate that we do not have that ability?
Well, I think we cited AT&T v. U.S., AT&T v. FCC, I think, which is a decision out of the D.C. Circuit, and I think there's another Supreme Court case in there somewhere that perhaps staff cited, which I think indicates that under the Administrative Procedures Act anyway, a change of law does not require an opening of reopening of the record, and that a carrier is entitled to a determination of its application or petition based on the law that's in effect at the time. In terms of whether this commission has discretion, I guess I'd rather choose not to speak to that. I mean, I think you all are in the best position to make that call. I think that very strongly, if you look at the law and you look at fundamental fairness, you look at the Administrative Procedures Act, I think there's no question but that we have a record and we're pretty far down the road here, and RCC should have a decision based on the law that's in place today. I think that's clearly where the FCC came out. And so to the extent that you want to follow anything the FCC did, I would say, follow it, none of it, or follow all of it in terms of deciding to hold a rulemaking to add additional requirements. Also, I would say then go right, that's in A, and then go to B, which is and do so outside of the context of this proceeding, which is what they did.
Thank you. My last question is, if some of the rules are beneficial to the consumer and if we have the ability to apply those, then would it not be in the best interest to the consumer for this commission to apply those new requirements?
No. And I say that because I think you can balance this. I think that the balancing here is as follows. The number one thing that you want to do is you want to get these cell sites built. You want to get the funds into the state, and you want to force this carrier to build something and get this done in 2005. And I think that's why you do the designation now. If you reopen the record, I think you're going to, without question, forego 1.5 million or some substantial portion of that would come into this state and build these four cell sites that RCC has proposed out here. And I think the public interest, the consumer interest, is much greater in these four communities in these areas in getting these cell sites done in 2005 than it is to reopen this record to determine whether RCC can properly handle a traffic spike, for example.
Thank you. Any further questions?
I just had one quick one based on that. Then I know you objected to one of staff's conditions that said that you would build those four sites in 2005. If the commission were to designate you within the next 30 days, I suppose we'd have to have redefinition too. Do you have an objection to the commission requiring those four cell sites to be built within, this year or maybe the first part of next year?
I don't think I can answer that factually on behalf of the client, unfortunately, but what I would say is this. It's unclear to me as of today when the designation, based on when the designation would be made, there is a lag time between the designation and the receipt of funds, and that could be as late as September. The ability of a company, let's say in September, to do four cell sites will depend on how many dollars it actually gets. How does the weather go when you get into towards the winter in terms of construction and the ability to pour concrete and all the other things that they may need to do? And so from a very practical standpoint, I couldn't make that commitment. The commitment I can make is that once the funds start flowing, those four cell sites, I think their commitment in the application was 18 months. Those four cell sites are going to get done within 18 months, and if they don't, RCC is going to come back to you and explain to you why it didn't happen and what they did with those funds.
Thank you.
I had some questions about Mr. LaFleuria's sort of economic analysis, but the more I think about them, they're mostly argumentative and academic in nature, so I'll forego that.
Thank you.
Fair enough. Happy to argue always. Fair enough. Thank you.
Thank you all very, very much. We appreciate the presentation, the information that you provided to us. It was for someone who has sat through the ETC hearings prior. I would have preferred to sit through just this portion, but I found it all very educational and appreciated the additional information we received. This will conclude the hearing.